criminologist and a former scammer who now works to help prevent fraud.
When it's successful, it completely wipes people out.
The new series of Scam Secrets, tomorrow lunchtime at 12. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 1st of April. Good morning. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb.
Good morning. The headlines. President Trump has said US attacks on Iran could end very soon, with or without a deal. When they did, and when they do, fuel prices could come tumbling down, or would come tumbling down, I should say. The weight loss drug Wegovy is to be prescribed on the NHS in England for more than a million patients at risk of heart disease.
And also in today's programme, strap in, after more than half a century, today is the day we blast off back to the moon. Well, at least in theory. We'll be hearing from one of NASA's senior scientists working on the Artemis project.
The human eye and the human brain and the human hands are the most sophisticated scientific instruments that I can think of. Having the opportunity to have these people really figure out how to infuse science into this enterprise is just very gratifying.
And we mark another anniversary as well, 50 years of Apple.
Every company in the world claims that they strive for excellence, but Apple, its culture is really something different. It is very intense there. And when they say they strive for excellence, I mean, they go miles out of their way.
The BBC News read this morning by Jane Steele.
President Trump says US attacks on Iran could end very soon and indicated a timeline of 2 or 3 weeks. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Trump said such a move would bring fuel prices tumbling down. His Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has said they can see the finish line. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
This is President Trump's clearest signal since the war began, that he intends to end it soon, having achieved his goals. He'd previously urged Iran to negotiate, and while he said Tehran was now begging for a deal, he insisted it wasn't necessary to stop military operations.
No, they don't have to make a deal with me. When we feel that they are, for a long period of time, put into the Stone Ages, and they won't be able to come up with a nuclear weapon, then we'll leave. Whether we have a deal or not, it's irrelevant.
He said Iran now had new leaders who were much more accessible, much less radicalized, and more rational compared with their predecessors. For his part, Iran's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has said Tehran has the necessary will to end the war with the United States and Israel, provided certain conditions are met, including guarantees that there would be no return to conflict. His comments were carried by Iranian state media, but it's unclear how much authority they carry within Iran's leadership.
Iran has continued to come under bombardment with reports of strikes on northern and central Tehran. US Central Command has released a video showing its forces dropping what it called precision munitions on underground military targets deep inside the country. In the Gulf, a tanker has been hit by an unknown projectile off Qatar. A fire has broken out at Kuwait's international airport following Iranian drone strikes on fuel tanks. Fresh overnight attacks have also been reported in Bahrain. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that any possible government support to help people with their energy bills may not come until the autumn. Speaking to BBC Breakfast, she has confirmed that if required, the package would be based on household income. The exact details are still to be worked out. Ms. Reeves indicated that any money would be when people needed it most.
From July to September, gas usage, especially by families and pensioners, is the lowest of any months of the year because it is the summer months. And then it will be really from the autumn onwards that people's gas usage starts increasing. So at the moment, we're working on a range of contingencies.
A Russian military transport plane has crashed over Crimea, killing 29 passengers and crew on board. The country's defence ministry has blamed a technical malfunction. It said the aircraft had flown into a cliff. Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. The Ukrainian authorities haven't commented on the crash. The NHS in England is to prescribe the weight loss drug Wegovy to more than a million overweight patients at risk of heart attacks and strokes. The health watchdog, NICE, says the drug offers an extra layer of protection. The NHS has described it as a life-changing treatment option. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports. The drug is one of the GLP-1 semaglutides, which are already used by the NHS for weight loss and diabetes. Clinical data from the SELECT trial showed the drug reduced heart attacks and strokes by 20% when used alongside standard medicines such as statins. Interestingly, benefits were seen before people had lost significant amounts of weight, suggesting it works directly on the heart and blood vessels. Eligible patients will be prescribed Wegovy from this summer, now that a deal has been struck between the NHS and its manufacturer, Novo Nordisk. A man has been charged after seven people were injured in Derby at the weekend when a car drove onto a pavement. Sandhu Ponachan, who's 36 and from the city, will appear in court later. Three people remain in hospital. Here's Aruna Iyengar.
Sandhu Ponachan was arrested shortly after the incident and was held for questioning before being charged last night. He's accused of six counts of grievous bodily harm with intent, as well as attempted GBH with intent, dangerous driving and possession of a bladed article. Police are again asking the public to come forward with information about what happened, including footage from CCTV, dash cams or mobile phones. They say the incident has sent shockwaves through Derby and the county as a whole. Counter-terrorism officers initially joined the investigation, but police have since said that it is not being treated as terrorism.
Pressure is mounting on the BBC after two newspapers made fresh claims in relation to the sacking of the Radio 2 breakfast presenter Scott Mills. The reports involve a Metropolitan Police investigation from 2018, which examined historical allegations of serious sexual offences relating to a teenage boy who was under 16. Scott Mills has not said anything publicly since he was fired. Our culture correspondent Noor Nanji reports.
The Sun says that, according to a source, Scott Mills told the BBC he had been questioned by police and that he had denied the claims against him. The paper says that managers allowed him to continue working while the police investigated. In a separate report, the Mirror claimed that his sacking was the result of fresh information that the BBC was told last week. The BBC declined to comment on both of these stories. So far, the corporation has given few details, but the questions are mounting over what it may or may not have known at the time and what led to the sudden departure of the Radio 2 DJ.
Football: Italy have failed to qualify for the World Cup for the third tournament in a row. They lost on penalties in their playoff against Bosnia-Herzegovina last night. Italy have won the World Cup four times and no previous winner has missed three successive finals.
Jane, thanks very much. It's 7 minutes past six. Now let's have our first look on the programme at the latest on the weather. Stav Danaos is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning. Hi, Stav.
Hi there, Emma and Justin. Good morning to you. Well, we ended March on a mild spring-like note for many. Plenty of sunshine around. We saw a high of 21 degrees recorded at Pershore in Worcestershire, making it the warmest day of the year so far for England, and matches the 21 also recorded in Wales back on the 18th of March. Now we're into the start of April. Much of England-Wales Day will see a similar sort of day, although perhaps not quite as warm as yesterday, and we should see more cloud around in general. Meanwhile, stronger winds, outbreaks of rain will push into the northern half of the UK as the day wears on. So today, many places starting dry, variable cloud, clear spells, also some patchy fog. Scotland and Northern Ireland, though, will continue to see that cloud thickening through the morning, with outbreaks of rain pushing in from the northwest, some of it turning out heavy across western Scotland during the afternoon. Northern Ireland might see brighten up a little bit into the afternoon, but there will be a few showers around. Winds picking up in the north with freshening northerly winds developing. So it'll feel cooler across Scotland and Northern Ireland compared to yesterday. Temperatures range from 7 to 13 degrees from north to south. England and Wales also starting dry with variable clouds, some mist and fog patches, a few bright spells. It's likely to be a bit cloudier than yesterday overall, though there should still be the odd sunny interval. Winds will remain light and westerly, but northwest England, north Wales will turn cloudier through the afternoon with outbreaks of rain developing and winds freshening from the northwest. Temperatures will reach 12 to 15 degrees, so fairly mild day, especially across southeast England. As we head through tonight, the rain moves south, fizzles out, so it'll be a chillier night with clear skies. Tomorrow, a calm day with some sunny spells around. Not as mild, but it does start to turn unsettled Friday and into the Easter weekend.
Stav, thank you for that. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let us have a look at the papers. I started it, you finish it, is the Metro's headline after President Trump reportedly infuriated allies, including
urging the UK by telling them to go get your own oil from the blockaded Strait of Hormuz. The Daily Mail says Mr. Trump's taunt exposes a prime minister without a plan, but the Mirror describes the US president as unhinged, pointing out it was his shambolic war against Iran that shut the waterway. This is Oil Your Fault, is its headline.
King sent on mission to salvage a century of friendships. That's the I newspaper's lead. The paper says the announcement of the state visit next month came just minutes after Donald Trump's outburst against allies about oil. The Guardian reports on what it calls a tentative sign of a more proactive European pushback against the Iran war. The paper says France blocked Israeli planes from flying weapons through its airspace, and Italy refused last-minute permission for US bombers to land in Sicily.
The Sun says BBC bosses are being urged to say why the radio host Scott Mills was kept on air, despite them reportedly knowing that he'd been interviewed by the police in 2018 about sex offences involving a boy under the age of 16. The case dropped in 2019 for lack of evidence. The paper says the BBC has remained tight-lipped over what changed since the alleged original decision not to act.
According to The Times, an MP whose husband is accused of spying for China has been reported for inappropriate conduct with a senior naval officer working on Britain's nuclear deterrent. Joni Reid reportedly got carried away at a drinks reception during a visit to a naval base last year. A source close to Ms. Reid said claims she had been reported because of national security concerns. What opportunistic hypocrisy.
Japan, declares the Daily Mirror. The Sun opts for down the pan as the back pages of a criticism of England's 1-0 defeat at Wembley last night. This, I think, is about football. The Guardian says fans who stayed until the final whistle booed with feeling. The only blessing, according to the Express, is that at least the World Cup is not just around the corner. Aha, that's a joke. I think it is, Emma, though neither of us would know.
It's good for you to badge it. 11 minutes past six.
Donald Trump is to address the nation, his nation, on the subject of Iran. But even before that address, he seems to be suggesting to Americans that the war might end soon, as I've been hearing from our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
This appears to be a significant shift in tone from the president, having spent much of the past few weeks urging Iran to do a deal and repeatedly saying that talks were underway and going well, although Iran never confirmed that direct talks were happening. Mr. Trump is now saying that Tehran doesn't have to do a deal. He says it's irrelevant and that the US will cease military operations when he is satisfied that his original goal of ensuring that Iran can never develop a nuclear weapon has been achieved. As he puts it, when we feel that they are, for a long period of time, put into the Stone Ages and they won't be able to come up with a nuclear weapon, then we'll leave, whether we have a deal or not. And the president suggests that that will happen in the next 2 to 3 weeks after he says the US finishes the job. And he went on to say that Iran now has new leaders who are much more accessible, much less radicalized and more rational compared to their predecessors. And he predicted that when the war does end, fuel prices will come tumbling down. And shortly after those comments from the president in the Oval Office, the White House announced that he will be addressing the nation tonight, a live primetime TV address to, as the press secretary Caroline Levitt put it, provide an important update on Iran.
Meanwhile, Marco Rubio has been providing an important update on their thinking about NATO.
Yes, interestingly, he has spoken to Fox News and he says that once the conflict ends, the United States may reconsider its role in NATO, since the war had raised questions about the alliance's value. He also, I think, reflected similar sentiments to the president, saying that an end to the war is in sight. He said, we can see the finish line. He said, while Tehran remains publicly defiant, its officials are being more cooperative in private discussions. He says there is the potential for a direct meeting at some point. He says we're always going to be open to that. But he also seemed to confirm that the discussions so far have been in the form of an exchange of messages.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
13 minutes past six. Another mess at the BBC, and that's not even covering what former Radio 2 breakfast presenter Scott Mills did or didn't do to merit his sacking, but more what the bosses here at the BBC did or didn't know. A newspaper has claimed the BBC knew years ago about him being questioned over historical allegations of serious sexual offences relating to a teenage boy who was under the age of 16 but did nothing. Lizo Mazimba is our culture correspondent. Lizo, what can we say of this?
Well, we have so few facts to go on. This is the problem for everybody looking at this story. The Sun newspaper claimed last night, as you say, that the BBC did know about this police investigation into Scott Mills 10 years ago, an investigation where the CPS decided there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute and the case was closed. But the Sun's saying the BBC did know about it, so what should they have done about it then? But then again, we're also looking at did he actually leave last week? The Mirror newspaper is saying that it wasn't just because of the police investigation 10 years ago. They're saying that fresh information came into the BBC. The BBC was made aware of that last week, and that's what led to his departure. The BBC hasn't commented on any of this. Scott Mills hasn't commented on any of this. So we're still left floundering in the darkness as to the actual facts of why Scott Mills actually left the BBC. But it does leave the BBC with a lot of questions to answer. It needs to, you know, what did it know? When did it know it? Have they had any other complaints about Scott Mills? You know, the list of questions just goes on. A couple of days ago, it looked very much from the outside that the BBC had a difficult situation, that they had dealt with it promptly and swiftly. Now, suddenly, the questions are mounting up for the BBC, and all it's doing is referring back to its original statement, which is, while we do not comment on matters relating to individuals, we can confirm Scott Mills is no longer contracted to work with the BBC. So that's where we are.
As our culture correspondent, have you been given any steer as to when the BBC might make things clearer? And I ask that in light of us having a Director General that's leaving today, is that right?
Yes, this is his last day. The new Director right. General, acting Director General, takes to control tomorrow.
I mean, it's quite an interim period for the shortest-lived Director General starting today, ahead of Matt Britton, the former Google UK boss, taking on the reins of the corporation. But any idea when we might get more information?
We have absolutely no idea. The BBC have not given any indication to us that they are going to make any further comment on this, just referring back to their original statement that they don't comment on individual matters relating to people like Scott Mills. Scott Mills hasn't said anything. Of course, it's possible he may choose to say something in the future, but we have no idea if we will get any more firm information about this, either from sources inside the BBC, sources close to Scott Mills, or from reports in newspapers, which so far we've been able to absolutely confirm the truth of.
Well, in probably one of our more W1A exchanges, Lizo Mazimba, our culture correspondent, thank you.
17 minutes past six is the time. The Chancellor's due to meet supermarket bosses today with food costs set to rise, of course. Sean has more on that and the rest of the morning's business news. Morning, Sean.
Hi, Justin. Yeah, we've heard from food and drink manufacturers how rising prices for everything from fertiliser to packaging is impacting costs, increasing expectations of how much food prices will go up by this year. And we see energy costs and the way businesses pay for their energy change as well. Some energy-intensive industries are exempt from latest increases, but indoor growers of salad plants like tomatoes and cucumbers are not. There's a lot going on. Simon Conway is chair of the British Tomato Growers Association. Morning to you, Simon.
Good morning, Sean.
Just first up on, you know, this meeting, the Chancellor's meeting those running some of our biggest supermarkets today. Are you telling those running our supermarkets that you are expecting prices to be higher in the months to come than they have been?
Oh, Sean, I mean, our messaging to the whole supply chain is, yeah, the pressures on price are absolutely relentless. And it's inevitable that prices will need to go up. I think we have to remember, I've worked within this industry all my career. This is a brutally competitive industry operating on very low margins from grower, wholesaler to retailer. And the competitiveness, this Easter, you've got two of the major retailers coming out offering bags of potatoes, bags of carrots for 4p. They use fresh produce as an absolute battleground on price. So there is no margin in any of the parts of it to be able to absorb these kind of cost shocks we're seeing.
Is that an issue when we do have a cost shock and shoppers are then asked to pay more, that actually some of those deals on our fresh food are so low?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we, as a percentage of our income, in Britain, we pay a very low percentage compared to our neighbours, so in France and Germany, the cost of food is far more as part of their disposable income. So, you know, we have a very, very efficient supply chain, our supermarket supply chain, and it keeps prices low. And yeah, there's no room for any movement. It has to be then put through on price.
Should supermarkets be offering deals like that?
That's an interesting point. A lot of the industry thinks it doesn't send a good message that the value, and 4 pence for a 2 kilo bag of potatoes, that is clearly not the cost to produce that and get that into store. It is a fantastic deal, and for cost of living for people buying food, it's obviously great, but it doesn't send a great message to across the sector that is the value of food. And ultimately the grower has to fund that across the full year, because it always has to be paid for.
What are the consequences of having deals like that?
I think the reality of the cost of food and production then in consumers' minds gets warped. I think, you know, and then when it goes back to the normal price, you know, the perception could be that, well, you know, they're being ripped off. So I do understand why they do it. It's a battleground to get people. They're using fresh produce to get people in the store and buy lots of other things. But from the industry perspective, it's not a great thing.
What's the biggest pressures at the moment for tomato growers in the UK? Where are you feeling things are unmanageable at the minute?
Well, it's interesting. We spent the last 6 months battling for energy fixed standing charges, which actually happened today. So the government is putting broadly £3.5 billion of extra cost across consumers and industry to help upgrade the grid. Industry is taking 1.7 billion of that, and that happens today. Now, as tomato growers, we're high energy users in a lot of our sites. So a lot of our sites are exporting electricity to the grid. So one of my largest sites supplies electricity for 40,000 households in Kent. Having that grid connection, they're being penalised. And you mentioned earlier, there is the energy intensive energy exemption scheme, which protects a lot of business, protects the competitiveness of British industry. Horticulture is excluded from that. So they were already facing into, and we'd worked it out, 7 of my biggest sites, the increase from today is £3 million. What happened then at the end of February is the gas price shock with the Iranian conflict. Now, gas price has been bouncing around. I mean, they've effectively doubled. I looked at the price from yesterday, probably about 65%. So, and again, energy as an input cost, total cost to growing a pack of tomatoes is about a third of that cost. If a third of the cost has gone up between 60 and 100%, that's a big impact.
Do you see tomato growers in other countries where we may get tomatoes from having more support and therefore being able to tap into the British market more easily when there are energy spikes?
Absolutely.
Like this?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. You've got, Holland's always run a very favourable regime in terms of energy supports, whether it's discounts, but they are not facing into these network charges. So if I'm a grower in Kent, just over the water from Holland, they're facing into, I've got my largest grower facing £1 million of on cost today on just fixed network charges. Their competitor in Holland, only a few miles across the water, has not got that impact. So if I'm a supermarket choosing, am I going to buy Dutch, am I going to buy British, where are you going to choose?
Simon, thank you for your time this morning. Simon Conway there, Chair of the British Tomato Growers Association. I've got Emma Wall with me this morning, Chief Investment Strategist at Hargreaves Lansdowne. Emma, good morning. Where are we at just with the check-in on the investment markets this morning, given many will be sort of seeing headlines that we saw the price of oil rise in its largest amount on record through March?
Yeah, so this 24 hours, at the moment, rather than a sort of 5 to 7 year market cycle, we're living in sort of 24 hour market cycles. But currently, markets are looking positive. That's in part due to the sort of rhetoric that's coming out of the White House, this idea that Donald Trump is ready to call an end to the war without a resolution with Iran, and it will address the nation in Wednesday afternoon US time to give further detail. We've seen stocks rally off the back of that optimism, so the S&P 500 having one of its best days in the last 12 months. However, oil and gold price are kind of more circumspect, and we've seen slight uptick in the oil price, which suggests that although the stock market is ready to have that optimism, it's not quite the consensus view and recognising that it might not be enough for the US just to say we've won for sort of energy disruption to be alleviated.
And continuing the food theme this morning, Emma, Unilever, you know, huge food manufacturer, has agreed to merge its food arm with a massive American-based food company, one of the biggest food deals in history. Explain what this one's all about.
Yeah, they're calling it a global flavour powerhouse. It's Unilever really spinning off its food businesses to focus on the personal care and consumer brands, so things like Lynx, Shaw, Dove. We've had rumours that this is what Unilever was looking to do, to become much more focused on the personal care and consumer brand side. We weren't sure what that meant for the food business, and we found out in the last 24 hours that what it means is, as you say, combining with McCormick, which is a US-listed business, but Unilever, crucially, will retain 65% of that business in terms of revenues. And it means that, you know, it will result in, they're expecting nearly £500,000 in annual cost savings.
Right.
And it brings together brands such as kind of Cholula hot sauce, French mustard, obviously Helms mayonnaise, pot noodle. So yes, a global flavour powerhouse.
Just in shopping list there as well. So that's good to know they're all under the same watch. Now, Emma, thank you for your time this morning. Emma Wall from Hargreaves Lansdown, the United States Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell this week warned that he's watching for risks of contagion in the banking system. One area of particular interest was private credit, where two of the biggest names, Ares and Apollo, have capped fund withdrawals. So this is, there's lending that goes on that isn't in the traditional banking way. Latest sign of strain, perhaps, on this big market. Hugh Van Steeners is vice chair at Oliver Wyman, former advisor to Mark Carney when he was governor at the Bank of England as well. Hugh, good morning to you. Are you actually seeing this strain play out at all? We've had, you know, the boss of Legal & General in recent weeks tell us they're not too concerned.
Look, I think the other bit of the quote you didn't say from Chairman Powell was that he didn't see problems now, but he's just obviously watching it like all good regulators should. No, look, I think this is a market where there are sort of, you know, some problems. But let's be clear, you know, private credit is a category which is about 40 trillion. The area the market's really focused on and where there's some jitters is the leverage lending market. So this is helping provide finance to companies who get acquired. That's about a 1.7 trillion area. And there's sort of good news and bad news here. You know, over the last 5 to 10 years, they've been particularly keen to fund software companies. But of course, now with Claude coming along, you know, and other AI agents, people are reassessing the quality of those loans. And so something like about a quarter of the loans that private credit firms have made in closed-end vehicles in the States were to software companies. And the real nub of the issue is, what's AI going to do to those loans? And there's clearly some natural jitters. And the truth is, we don't yet know, but the likelihood is AI will have an impact, and therefore there's a real sort of reassessment of the value of those loans. And so that's where the nub of the issue is.
And if when people hear reassessment of value of loans, that might take people back a couple of decades to around the time of the major financial crisis that we had. What then, Hugh, should be being done right now if there are senses that there might be some concerns out there about the valuation of these loans and the ripple effect of that? What can be done to protect us from having an impact right across many, many sectors and the cost of borrowing for many people?
I'll give you an answer, but just put it in context. You know, this isn't the overall market. I mean, so probably half of what private credit firms do is help insurers put money to work. Less than 1% of that will be non-investment grade lending. So that whole piece is a much higher quality. Again, doesn't mean that the odd company may not go bust, but these are high quality loans and are separate from this issue. In this particular era, of course, you want a bit more data. I mean, part of the challenge here is this sector has grown 20% per annum for the last decade. It's grown very strongly. And now we need a bit more disclosure. And so you've got a couple of things. The regulators are having a look. The US insurance regulator, in fact, our own Bank of England, is doing an investigation into the interlinkages, which it's working on at the moment. But also the companies themselves are providing more data. And so in the States, one of the companies you mentioned has teamed up with the ICE, the Intercontinental Exchange, to provide a kind of a common data lake so people can really look at the quality and the value of these loans.
Right.
But I do think there's sort of progress on this, but also, Sean, the linkages to the banking system are just simply not as great as they were in the financial crisis. This is a much smaller space.
Hugh, thank you. Hugh Van Steenis there, Vice Chair at Oliver Wyman.
Sean, we'll speak to you a bit later on, but at 28 minutes past six, time for our first look at the sports news. Mike's just walked in. Good morning.
Hello, Emma. Let's start, shall we, with a couple of underwhelming friendly defeats for England and Scotland last night. At Wembley, Thomas Tuchel made 10 changes to the England side that drew with Uruguay last week, and they were beaten 1-0 by Japan. Captain Harry Kane was rested by Tuchel for that match after picking up a knock in training. Meanwhile, at Everton's Hill Dickinson Stadium, Scotland were beaten 1-0 by the Ivory Coast. Here's their manager, Steve Clarke.
Disappointing to lose again. Like I always say for friendly matches, some things good that I can take out, some things bad. I thought we started the game really well. Got caught on counter-attack, which was a cheap goal to lose. And we didn't react very well to losing the goal. We sort of lost control of the game a little bit. First half became a little bit of a struggle. I thought second half we were excellent.
Elsewhere, Wales and Northern Ireland, who you'll remember failed to qualify for this summer's tournament last week, played out a one-all friendly draw in Cardiff. Elsewhere in World Cup qualifying, it was a busy old night, and the big shock of the evening came in Pristina.
Bosnia Herzegovina will play at the World Cup. Italy beaten. Their worst nightmares have come true. The unthinkable has happened. One of the globe's great football nations will not be at the finals.
Yes, in a big upset, the four-time world champions Italy have failed to qualify for a third World Cup in a row after a penalty shootout defeat by Bosnia-Herzegovina. And this has never happened to any previous winner of the World Cup before. Bosnia, though, are through to the tournament for only the second time as an independent nation. There will be one English manager at the World Cup this summer. Graham Potter's Sweden are going to the tournament thanks to an 88th-minute winner from the Arsenal striker Viktor Gyökeres last night to help them beat Poland 3-2 in their playoff final in Stockholm. Turkey also qualified for the first time in 24 years. They beat Kosovo, and the Czech Republic beat Denmark on penalties. And then overnight, the final two places at the World Cup have been confirmed via the Intercontinental Playoff Tournament in Mexico. I can tell you DR Congo are going back to the World Cup for the first time since 1974 when they competed as Zaire. They beat Jamaica in a playoff. And in the last few minutes, the last 20 minutes or so, Iraq have beaten Bolivia by 2-1, meaning Iraq are at the World Cup for the first time since 1990. I've been speaking to someone inside the Iraqi camp earlier this week. He was so excited. He said, if Iraq meet the World Cup, it'll be the greatest day of my life. I've just been texting. I'm trying to get hold of him for the next hour of the programme. British-born Iraqi out with the side in Mexico. He, I'm sure, is celebrating.
Brilliant. Thank you, Mike. Time for a quick preview now of new late-night comedy arriving on Radio 4 this evening.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here.
Hi, Roger. It's Brian.
These are the voice notes of Brian and Roger.
I've had a word with Paul, and he's willing to accept the bet if you live in a bin for a week instead of me.
A dark comedy about friendship.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here. Yeah, I'll take some reading with me. I've got a sleeping bag. Yeah.
One of them is nice. One of them isn't.
Hello, Brian. Are you going to come down today? I could really do with some water and some fruit.
Brian and Roger, the cult hit comedy, comes to Radio 4 with 6 exclusive episodes starting tonight at 11. All hear the best of box set now on BBC Sounds.
It's 28 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. Thank you for being with us with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. And now a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
President Trump has said the US military operation in Iran could end very soon, suggesting it may take 2 or 3 weeks to, in his words, finish the job. Mr. Trump said such a move would bring fuel prices tumbling down. He also claimed Iran's military equipment had been decimated. There have been reports of strikes on parts of the Iranian capital, Tehran. Elsewhere, a tanker near Qatar has been hit by an unknown projectile, while Iranian drone strikes have hit Kuwait's international airport. Attacks have also been reported in Bahrain. Israel's military says it has carried out 2 separate strikes targeting senior members of Hezbollah in Beirut. It hasn't identified them or said whether or not they were killed. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that possible government support to help people to pay their energy bills may not be available until the autumn. She told the BBC that if required, the measures would take into account household income. The NHS in England is to prescribe the weight loss drug Wegovy to more than 1 million overweight patients at risk of heart attacks and strokes. Data showed the drug reduced such medical emergencies by 20% when used alongside standard medicines such as statins. The NHS has described it as a life-changing treatment option. A man has been charged after a car drove onto a pavement in Derby at the weekend. Seven people were injured and three remain in hospital. Sandhu Punachan, who's 36 and from the city, is due in court later. The tech giant Apple is marking its 50th anniversary. The company was founded on the 1st of April 1976 and its Apple One computer went on sale in July the same year.
Thank you for that. Just coming up to 25 to 7, we are heading back to the moon and we're doing it today. At least that's the plan. Georgina Renard, our science reporter, is on the line. What, Georgina, is the plan?
Morning, Justin. Well, this is obviously a very exciting but tense time for NASA and the four astronauts who they hope to fly near the moon. It would be the first mission to get humans close to the lunar body in more than 50 years. So the two-hour launch window starts at 6:24 local time at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. That's 11:24 our time in the UK. It's been a bumpy road to get here. This huge rocket will blast them into space, but it's only flown once before, and that was without humans. And then there was a lot of damage to the heat shield that is supposed to protect astronauts. But at a press conference last night, NASA said it was very confident the launch will go ahead, that the weather conditions are right. There's a few white fluffy clouds that NASA could be problematic, but NASA hopes they'll go away. And a powerful solar flare that was emitted could also cause a little problem. But as I said, they're very optimistic that it will go tonight.
And when they get into space, when they get there, what do they do?
Well, this is a moon mission that won't actually land on the moon this time. Instead, the crew of four, so it's a 10-day mission, they'll fly around the far side of the moon, which is the side we never see. They'll make observations, take pictures. But it is part of a bigger program, a step towards a planned human landing in 2028, which is the real goal, and that would be the real prize. This is one of Donald Trump's pet projects he established under his first presidency. And if NASA do pull this off, we can expect him to be very jubilant about that.
And also all of it being done in very much in competition with the Chinese, who effectively sort of want to do the same thing, don't they? At roughly the same time. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, China said they aim to land humans by 2030. Artemis, the next stage of Artemis, says it would be 2028. But actually, many experts and observers say they expect China to beat America and land humans on the moon first. If they pull this mission off tonight, it will be seen as a big victory. It's the first big test in the new global space race. But the real prize, of course, is actually putting human feet, human boots, as America puts it, back on the moon. And that is definitely not going to happen today.
Georgina Renard, thank you.
It is 24 minutes to 7. So far this week, we've had Sir Keir Starmer meeting business leaders on Monday and having a meeting of the Emergency Cobra Committee yesterday, all about the cost of living. What do we know of the government's plan? The Chancellor has been speaking to the BBC. Henry Zeffman's here, our chief political correspondent. Henry, it's not an April Fool when she's talking about what's happening on April 1st. We're heading towards the end of the tax year and there are changes.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this interview that the Chancellor's given to Peter Ruddock from BBC Breakfast does have some new hints, I think, on what package of support may come forth from the government. The first hint is that it's some way off. Rachel Reeves talking about how the autumn will be when people's gas usage starts increasing. I'm taking that as a hint, perhaps no more than that, that a package of support for household bills would come not when the new bit of the energy price cap, which started today and means bills will fall for many, runs out in July, but actually in October, because that's when people start using heating. She also talked about targeted measures being based on household income, though she said it was too early to say what form that would take. But that is interesting because sometimes in the past, there's been complications with government trying to assess things based on household income rather than individual income and getting that data. Notable too, by the way, that Sir Keir Starmer is going to be talking about these matters and others in a press conference from Downing Street later this morning. I suspect that he will have the positions of other parties put to him who want the government to act sooner. The Conservatives and Reform UK calling on the government to remove VAT from household energy bills. Liberal Democrats talking about reducing costs by changing how new renewable projects are paid for. The Green Party want a package to ensure that bills won't rise in July. And then in Wales, Plaid calling on the government to offer broader direct support, as are the SNP in Scotland.
In terms of the energy debate and what the opposition have now been saying for some time around get drilling, there's the reality that there could be British gas, there could be the energy extracted from British gas and oil fields earlier than anticipated. And that would be, if we don't go in that direction, that could become a headache, couldn't it, for the government if Ed Miliband's strategy and the commitment to net zero is followed, you know, in a time that the government couldn't have predicted.
I mean, the government position to not allow new licences for exploration in the North Sea, which, as you say, has come under political pressure from the Conservatives and Reform UK, and I'm sure that pressure will only intensify, but there are no signs whatsoever that that government position is going to budge. Interesting interview in the Times this morning by Neil McCulloch, who's the chief executive of Adura, which is the company behind the Jackdaw gas field. Now, that was what Kemi Badenoch was raising at PMQs last week. He said that if permission were granted, Jackdaw could have energy being supplied as soon as October, meaning that Britain would be less reliant on foreign imports. Now, it's actually slightly by the by to the policy of not granting new oil and gas licences, because this is a quasi-judicial process. It was originally approved by the Conservatives and then overturned by the courts. But I do think it is another example of how these questions of energy policy are going to be at the heart of our politics, probably for months, if not even years to come.
Well, we will be talking to the Business and Trade Secretary, Peter Kyle, just after 7:30, and I hope to be able to put some of these questions around energy and business and the government strategy to him. Henry Zeffman, our Chief Political Correspondent, thank you.
20 to 7 is the timeline. Let's catch up with what's been happening in the Middle East overnight, including an attack on an oil tanker off the coast of Qatar. Katie Watson is our correspondent who is in Doha at the moment. Tell us about that, Katie, and everything else that's been going on.
Yeah, so there's a tanker just north of Doha. It was hit by an unknown projectile. There's no environmental impact, no casualties. But in Kuwait, there was a fuel depot that was targeted by drones at the international airport. There was some damage, no casualties again. Bahrain has also come under fire. Saudi has intercepted some drones. You know, this is clearly, a part of the Middle East that gets hit, especially when you see Iran being hit overnight as well. It seems to be, you know, retaliation. And that's something that we've seen in the last, five weeks. So clearly this part of the Middle East has got its head down, not saying much in response to what Trump has been saying and what Iran has been saying in response. It just doesn't want any escalation. That's something that the Qataris told me yesterday. They're clearly concerned that if this escalates, there could be far worse consequences. Their main concern is on civilian infrastructure, such as desalination plants, for example.
The United Arab Emirates, meanwhile, reported, at least in the Wall Street Journal, to be considering joining US action to keep the Straits of Hormuz open. No details about what that action exactly could be, but interesting that they feel that their position is so desperate really now, that it is so vital to them that that strait is reopened, that they might actually join it militarily.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, this is where there's a discussion about whether the Gulf needs to work together and be unified. Certainly, there are different interests. The UAE has been hit much harder than other parts of the Gulf. And clearly, there's also an awful lot of Iranians who live in the UAE. That's a very big population there. I think that's where they need to work out whether it's better in unison to be arguing for an end to war, or whether actually individual Gulf states decide that they want to perhaps kind of take a different path. And I think that's one of the big concerns, really, certainly, what that means for the vulnerability of the region if they do start to take different decisions.
Katie Watson in Doha. Thank you.
Just another look at 17 minutes to seven at some of the stories in the papers. We've covered quite a few of the front pages, but there's a story across the papers around the King's first state visit to the US in late April. It's being positioned as a salvaging of a 100-year friendship. He's been invited to attend a state dinner with President Trump to address a joint meeting of Congress, the first such royal address it would be since 1991. But it's also the invitation by a Democratic congressman to the King asking him to meet Jeffrey Epstein's victims during that visit that has also made headlines. The Times reporting this, writing it up. Ro Khanna, a representative from California, said a private meeting could identify additional information that may be able to open a dialogue about whether there will be full accounting of how Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell's network operated in the UK. That congressman co-authored the act that led to the release of those Epstein files by the US Justice Department. Buckingham Palace, it says here, was approached for comment about that specific invitation. And just another, which is really interesting, in The Guardian, tackling the housing crisis would increase the birth rates. That's what a piece of research by the Resolution Foundation has found. Politicians hoping to persuade young people in the UK to have, it says, more children, but maybe even have them to start with because of our declining birth rate. Actually, the focus should be on the ability to buy your own home. So a lot of detail on that report.
There is a story across the front page of The Times that children and young adults are being incentivized to get an ADHD or autism diagnosis as there's been a medicalization of distress. This according to a government inquiry. So it's an interim report. It was commissioned by Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary for England, and it's found apparently there are incentives to seek diagnosis because it is the gateway to unlock access to special adjustments at school and at work. So there is credible evidence, according to at least this interim report, of increasing psychological distress behind a rise in medical diagnosis. But normal difficulties may also be increasingly interpreted primarily through a medical lens. And one other NHS-linked story in the Mail, suggesting that the NHS is only days away from running out of critical supplies because of the Iran war. This according to its chief executive, Jim McKee, who's head of NHS England, saying he's really worried about a potential shortage of common items. So he's talking about syringes, masks, surgical instruments as well. He made his comments on LBC Radio. We're really worried about this. We already had a couple of supply shocks in the past 18 months or so. We've got a team to focus on where the risks may be across the government process.
It is a quarter to seven.
There is a big change on the nation's trains this morning. It involves refunds for tickets that you don't use. There is one man who will know all that there is to know about it, and he is Simon Calder, the travel journalist, travel reporter, travel correspondent, travel everything for The Independent and everyone else as well. Morning to you, Simon.
Good morning. I think you mean cheap and available.
You said it. No, but you do know, and you've watched for many years the ins and outs not only of our transport system but also of our ticketing, and it is hellishly complex, isn't it? Today, this is quite an important change.
Well, yes, and if you are a regular rail traveller, you might have noticed a big poster campaign at stations across the country over the past few weeks saying that ticket refund rules are changing. Now, this isn't going to affect anything to do with advance tickets. You can normally amend but not refund them. It's all about walk-up or flexible tickets. And if you buy, say, an anytime or off-peak ticket from today, if you decide not to travel, you can get a refund only if you apply before the ticket becomes valid. So, for example, if I had decided to spend an ambitious £193 on a one-way ticket on the 7 o'clock Avanti West Coast train this morning from Manchester to London, then I decided not to travel, I'd need to have applied for a refund before midnight last night. And that is in total contrast with the previous rule, which would allow me to get my money back, minus a £5 handling charge, on the day of travel or any time in the following 4 weeks.
Why the change?
Well, the old system, which I believe dates back to the 19th century, certainly benefited some passengers who bought tickets, but then their plans changed for personal or professional reasons, but it was also royally exploited by fraudsters to the tune, says the railway industry, of £40 million a year. And until now, I haven't been able to talk about how the swindle works because it could have encouraged, obviously not your listeners, but other people to try it. Here's, as they say in crime dramas, the MO. You would buy a ticket, set about trying to make the journey without getting your ticket clipped or scanned, maybe using open stations without barriers, maybe tailgating passengers through the automatic gates. If you succeeded, you put your ticket in for a refund, which reduced the cost of pretty much any journey to £5, the refund fee. And unlike travelling completely without a ticket, the only downside was the ticket might be checked, at which point all that happened was that you paid the appropriate fare.
So, and was there evidence that this was being done on a kind of grand scale?
Oh yes, and there have been cases, for instance, a couple of Leeds students exploited not just this rule, but also the fact that you could claim delay repay for a ticket you'd already claimed back, and that costs the taxpayer, the passenger, over £140,000. Interestingly, I imagined everyone would be delighted that a gaping loophole costing almost £1 million a week had been closed. But I've had a lot of pushback, and indeed people have said I've been paid by the government to promote this change, and they say the real fraud is the level of ticket prices and that this will penalise passengers who are ill on the day of travel. But the rail industry says, look, it will look kindly at exceptional circumstances.
Oh, that's interesting. So if you said, look, I have had this has happened to me and that's why I didn't travel, you might still get your money.
Oh yes, if you've got a reasonable excuse for it. And, of course, in the event of disruption, if you can't travel because of cancellations or excessive delays, sure, you get a refund anyway.
OK, Simon Calder, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
11 minutes to 7. The government is introducing a package of measures this morning aimed at tackling the cost of living crisis. This includes increasing the minimum wage and the living wage. But what about businesses? And those who, of course, are running those businesses facing sky-high energy bills. Lord Richard Harrington is the chair of Make UK, the representative body of UK manufacturing. Previously, he was the Conservative MP for Watford. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you think this government can be described as pro-business?
I'm afraid, unfortunately, I would have to say I think this government is very anti-business. They do a lot of words. They talk about growth. They talk about we have endless round tables and discussions. But many of the measures that are coming in today to do with a ridiculous increase in employers' national insurance, which is about £1,000 per employee alone, are really, I have to say, they do not really understand the consequences on business.
There might be those listening thinking, well, you're a former Conservative MP. How can I trust what you say about this this government's record? And what about the people? The people need to have more money in their pocket.
Well, they do, absolutely. But in the end, it's the companies that people work for that pay their wages. And those companies have to make a profit in order for them to continue employing people. And about 26,000 companies that belong to us, we do regular surveys. Unfortunately, 27% said in the most recent one that they plan to make people redundant because of the national insurance increase alone, let alone now the new changes in business rates, sick pay, and many other things before we even get onto energy costs. Because what these really do is make the products that are manufactured uncompetitive compared to French, German, US companies. And of course, for the multinational companies who employ so many people here, the cost of producing the product, be it a car, be it a steel product, etc., is significantly more, part of which was because of our increase in labour costs.
But you can see why the government is doing what it's doing. You know, the idea that the national living wage, it being increased helps people on lower wages have a level that they can live, you know, a better life, spend more. I accept what you're saying, but whether that balance is quite right, there will be many listening to this who think businesses can afford to absorb some of this.
Well, no one that actually runs or operates a business would say that. But of course,
It depends on the size and the scale of the business and what they've been paying previously as well, doesn't it? And how well they're doing.
It does. First of all, I don't think any one of our members would want to exploit working people and pay them a wage that they couldn't live on. But when we start now with an increase of the minimum wage, which starts at 18 years old. So people want to take on young people, they want to take on apprentices, but it's a lot of money for an 18-year-old who probably isn't fully trained to pay. But then, you know, it's all part of what costs are. Costs also include business rates, energy prices, which even before what's happened in Iran, were four times that of the US.
Just briefly, your message to Peter Kyle, the Business and Trade Secretary, if he could do something for businesses, he's coming on the programme at 7:30, what would you say?
Well, you tell Peter, who we see regularly, he's got to fight the battle with Ed Miliband, do something about energy prices for manufacturing.
I think we got that, the line slightly cut out. Sorry.
Subsidise manufacturing industry to get our factories competitive with those abroad.
Okay, I think we got that, certainly the first bit. Lord Richard Harrington, Chair of Make UK Now, thank you.
7 minutes to seven is the time. We're talking a lot today about the launch of the NASA Artemis mission to the moon. Humans going for the first time. If the mission's successful, they'll actually land there in 2028 or 2029. Will the Chinese, though, get there first? One of the subplots of what is happening with the launch today is that China is in the background with a space program very much of its own. Dr. Simeon Barber is on the line, who's a space scientist at the Open University. Morning to you.
Morning.
And the Chinese have plans, don't they?
Oh, the Chinese have plans, and those plans have been in place for the last 20 years, yeah.
Which are?
Well, they've come up with almost like a model program for how you would start exploring the moon, first with orbiters and then landers and more recently rovers. They've had 9 missions since 2007. Each one has been successful, which is remarkable in terms of success rate. They've made the first ever soft landing on the far side of the moon. They've brought samples back to Earth. They've brought the first ever sample from the far side that is hopefully will be analysed by my colleagues at the Open University. So, you know, they've got a really successful track record.
And is that track record linked? I mean, you think of their ability to I don't know, run high-speed trains and all the rest of it, or introduce high-speed trains, etc. Is part of it that they have that kind of stability in the background, that you know who's in charge and the people who are in charge will do what they want to do?
I think you've hit the nail on the head absolutely there. So, you know, space exploration is a long-term strategic endeavour if you want to do it properly. And if you have that stability and if you have the funding to make those plans happen, then you're in a really strong position. And this kind of contrasts with NASA's position, where their budgets are, you know, fluid. There are political tensions about where to go, whether to go to the moon, to Mars, to an asteroid. And China's really benefited from that stability.
And when it comes to actually getting there, say, for instance, China does get there and does put its own people on the moon relatively soon, what is the step that comes after that? What does it get them?
Yeah, well, what we're hearing at the moment is that this is not about going back to the moon to plant flags and leave footprints. This is more about a long-term presence. And that's what all actors that are in this game at the moment are looking to do. They're looking to establish lunar bases, which would give that long-term presence on the moon. It is a very strategically valuable place from a point of view of resources. And, you know, it's kind of the ultimate high ground, I guess you could say. But the people who are on the ground there, who are operating there, will be the ones that set the rules of the road. And this is quite important, because those will become the established norms about how we relate to the moon, how we operate there. Do we use its resources, or do we protect its resources? All that kind of stuff is going to be dictated by the people who have boots on the ground. And that's why nations are trying to get there and establish that presence.
Dr. Simeon Barber, thank you very much for that. Fascinating. We'll be talking much more about the Artemis mission and what they're hoping to achieve during the course of the next 2.5 hours or so. And, of course, the mission due, at least, to begin this evening.
If you need help on this, Monday, Monday, Monday. You're not alone. In the Martin Lewis podcast, I'll give you tips to keep more cash in your pocket and answer your important questions.
Now that we're starting from scratch, what's the best way for us to move forward?
To help your everyday finances just add up. Let's see what we can do. The Martin Lewis podcast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Weather time, stabbed and nails.
Thanks very much, Justin and Emma. Good morning to you. Yesterday was a mild, very spring-like day for many. There was a lot of sunshine around, even more than the forecast, actually. And that ended up pushing temperatures up to 21 Celsius at Pershore in Worcestershire, making that the warmest day of the year so far for England and matching the 21 Celsius recorded in Wales back on the 18th of March. So a very warm end to March. Now into April, much of England and Wales will see a similar sort of day today, although perhaps not quite as warm as yesterday, because we'll see more cloud around in general. Meanwhile, stronger winds and outbreaks of rain will start to push into the northern half of the country as the day wears on. So today, many places starting dry, variable cloud, clear spells, some patches of mist and fog, and generally for most, it's fairly mild. Now, Scotland, Northern Ireland, you'll see the cloud thickening quite quickly through the morning. Outbreaks of rain will push in from the northwest, some of it pepping up to be heavy across western Scotland through the afternoon. Northern Ireland, and in fact, the Western Isles should see some sunshine developing into the afternoon with one or two showers, but it will turn cold as we move through the day with northerly winds, freshening northerly winds setting in. So a cooler day compared to yesterday, temperatures range from 7 to around 12 degrees. England and Wales also starting dry, variable cloud, some mist and fog patches, quite dense around the Cotswolds at the moment. We will see a few glimmers of brightness here and there, but it is likely to be a bit cloudier than yesterday. Winds will remain light from the west, but northwest England and north Wales will start to turn cloudier as we head into the afternoon with outbreaks of rain pushing down from Scotland and Northern Ireland, so turning a little bit wetter and cooler here. Temperatures 12 to 15 degrees, still fairly mild for the time of year, especially towards southeast England. Into tomorrow, mainly dry variable clouds, sunny spells, light winds. It will be a chillier day to come. And then Scotland, Northern Ireland will turn wet and windier later on in the day. Temperatures range from 8 to 13 degrees.
Staff, Danaos there with the weather. Thank you. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett.
It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 1st of April. The headlines this morning. President Trump has said US forces are finishing the job in Iran and could end attacks very soon, whether or not there is a peace deal. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that any government help with energy bills won't happen until the autumn. And the NHS in England is to offer the weight loss drug Wegovy to more than a million people to reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes.
We'll go into more of the detail on that coming up. Also coming up in the next hour, more on the last-minute preparations. You've just been hearing a bit about the Artemis II space mission, with humanity about to head back to the moon for the first time in 50 years. I really hope it happens. And we speak to a former advisor to President Trump. Is he preparing to walk away from Iran and leave others to pick up the pieces?
I do not think Donald Trump is going to stop this campaign until the Strait of Hormuz is under the control of some kind of international body.
But first, the BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
President Trump says the US attacks on Iran could end very soon and indicated a timeline of 2 or 3 weeks. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Trump said such a move would bring fuel prices tumbling down. He's due to deliver a televised address to the nation about Iran tonight. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
This is President Trump's clearest signal since the war began that he intends to end it soon, having achieved his goals. He'd previously urged Iran to negotiate, and while he said Tehran was now begging for a deal, he insisted it wasn't necessary to stop military operations.
No, they don't have to make a deal with me. When we feel that they are, for a long period of time, put into the Stone Ages and they won't be able to come up with a nuclear weapon, then we'll leave. Whether we have a deal or not, it's irrelevant.
He said Iran now had new leaders who were much more accessible, much less radicalized, and more rational compared with their predecessors. For his part, Iran's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has said Tehran has the necessary will to end the war with the United States and Israel, provided certain conditions are met, including guarantees that there would be no return to conflict. His comments were carried by Iranian state media, but it's unclear how much authority they carry within Iran's leadership.
Explosions were heard across the Iranian capital, Tehran, overnight. Israel says it carried out what it called a wide-scale wave of strikes on the city. Gulf states have also been coming under attack, as our correspondent Katie Watson reports from Doha.
Overnight, US Central Command released a video showing its forces dropping what it called precision munitions on underground military targets deep inside Iran. Israel says it carried out an attack on a factory, which it claimed was involved in the production of chemical weapons. Iran, though, says it was making medicines. The Gulf continues to be targeted too. Fuel depots at Kuwait's international airport were hit by drones, causing a huge fire. Saudi Arabia said it had intercepted two drones. Bahrain was also attacked, and a tanker off the coast of Qatar was hit by an unknown projectile.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that any possible government support to help people with their energy bills may not arrive until the autumn. In an interview with BBC Breakfast, she said the Treasury was working on a range of contingencies. Our business correspondent Peter Raddick reports.
Energy bills for more than half of households in England, Scotland and Wales will fall from today thanks to a lower level in the Ofgem price cap. However, that cap is expected to jump significantly when reset in July. Rachel Reeves has previously said any help with bills, if needed, would be targeted. But now she's given the BBC more details.
It will be really from the autumn onwards that people's gas usage starts increasing. So at the moment, we're working on a range of contingencies and we are looking at more targeted measures. We're looking at ways in which we can support people based on their household income.
With prices already rising at the pumps, the government's also facing calls to follow other countries and cut taxes on petrol and diesel. The Chancellor said she had to be careful with promises to lower prices for everyone because it risked pushing up inflation, interest rates and taxes in the future.
The Conservatives and Reform UK want VAT to be removed from energy bills to help households. The Liberal Democrats say the link between gas prices and energy costs should be broken, while the Green Party is calling for higher taxes, including on capital gains, to keep bills down. In Scotland, the SNP says the price cap shouldn't be allowed to rise because of the war. Plaid Cymru wants broader direct support for households in Wales. Increases in the mandatory national living wage for nearly 2.7 million workers come into force today. For employees over the age of 21, their hourly pay will go up by 50 pence to £12.71. Those aged 18 to 20 will see their hourly rate rise by 85 pence to £10.85. But there are concerns in the hospitality sector that one in seven businesses risk going under. Here's our business editor, Simon Jack.
Workers on the national living wage will see an income boost of £900 a year, while younger workers will take home £1,500 a year more, according to the government, as measures announced last year take effect today. Good news for workers, but an additional cost pressure for businesses, particularly those that employ large numbers of younger, lower-paid staff, such as retail and hospitality. The government insists that a wage rise for the lowest paid staff is important when the cost of living remains a big concern. And union leaders point out that previous concerns that a rising minimum wage would lead to rising unemployment have proved unfounded in the past. But the employment rate among 16 to 24-year-olds recently hit its highest level in more than a decade.
The NHS in England is to prescribe the weight loss drug Wegovy to more than a million overweight patients at risk of heart attacks and strokes. The health watchdog NICE has recommended the drug, saying it offers an extra layer of protection. The NHS has described Wegovy as a life-changing treatment option. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports.
The drug is one of the GLP-1 semaglutides, which are already used by the NHS for weight loss and diabetes. Clinical data from the SELECT trial showed the drug reduced heart attacks and strokes by 20% when used alongside standard medicines such as statins. Interestingly, benefits were seen before people had lost significant amounts of weight, suggesting it works directly on the heart and blood vessels. Eligible patients will be prescribed Wegovy from this summer, now that a deal has been struck between the NHS and its manufacturer, Novo Nordisk.
A 36-year-old man has been charged after seven people were injured in Derby last weekend when a car drove onto a pavement in the city centre. Sandhu Punicham, whose police say is originally from India, has been accused of grievous bodily harm, dangerous driving and possession of a bladed article. He will appear in court today. Three people remain in hospital. Pressure is mounting on the BBC after two newspapers made fresh claims in relation to the sacking of the Radio 2 breakfast presenter Scott Mills. The reports involve a Metropolitan Police investigation from 2018, which examined historical allegations of serious sexual offences relating to a teenage boy who was under 16. Scott Mills has not said anything publicly since he was fired. More from our culture correspondent Noor Nanji.
The Sun says that according to a source, Scott Mills told the BBC he had been questioned by police and that he had denied the claims against him. The paper says that managers allowed him to continue working while the police investigated. In a separate report, the Mirror claimed that his sacking was the result of fresh information that the BBC was told last week. The BBC declined to comment on both of these stories. So far, the corporation has given few details, but the questions are mounting over what it may or may not have known at the time and what led to the sudden departure of the Radio 2 DJ. No charges were brought against Scott Mills after prosecutors in 2019 decided there was insufficient evidence to proceed with the case. Scott Mills has not responded to multiple requests for comment.
The golfer Tiger Woods has said he intends to seek treatment and concentrate on his health after a car crash in Florida last week. Court documents show the 15-time major champion has pleaded not guilty to driving under the influence. Woods said he recognised the seriousness of the situation he found himself in and that he wanted to return in a healthier, stronger and more focused place.
Jane, thanks very much. It's 8 minutes past seven. This evening, breaths will be held. NASA's Artemis II mission is finally nearing its launch after lots of delays. The 98-metre-tall moon rocket will be filled with millions of litres of explosive fuel, ready to be ignited at the end of the countdown. The four Artemis astronauts will get into their bright orange flight suits about 5.5 hours before the planned liftoff and then head to the launch pad, ready to be strapped into their seats at the very top of the rocket. There's a 2-hour launch window which opens late this evening. Eugene Cernan was an astronaut on the Apollo 17 moon mission, which took place in 1972. NASA says that he was the last human to leave his footprints on the lunar surface. He also wrote his daughter's initials on the moon. How cool is that? This is Eugene speaking in 2014, courtesy of Purdue University in Indiana.
I wanted to stop time. I wanted to hit the freeze button. Let me stop and think about where I am and what I'm doing. And I looked down at my footprints and I knew I wasn't coming back this way again. Somebody would. Not me. And what did it all mean? That we, not just Apollo 17, but we, Apollo, what did it mean that in our generation, in our time, we left our cradle and called another body in the universe our home, from Neil's first steps to my last? What did that mean? How can I answer the question, what's it like to go to the moon? I knew we were an extension of technology. We were on a scientific mission. We were studying geology. We wanted to, curiosity is the essence of human existence, so we wanted to get more answers and ended up with more questions.
More answers, more questions. Will some of them be answered tonight and going in tomorrow? Professor Kevin Fong is a consultant and ethicist and Professor of Public Engagement and Innovation at the University College London. He's a broadcaster and as a medical doctor used to work with NASA on human spaceflight and has, I believe, been through the application process to be an astronaut. Is that right, Kevin?
Yes, not successfully.
Well, you're sat here, so I'm sorry. What a consolation. Are you a bit jealous this evening?
I'm always jealous. I wish I was standing in Florida right now because it's just such an exciting time.
You know, before we get to perhaps some people's potential consternation, I don't wish to bring down what is a genuinely exciting moment. There is also the reality of the weather.
Oh, yes. So the weather is massively in play, but it's a pretty nice day out there at the moment. It's about 20, 22 degrees. They're worried about the clouds at the moment.
Why?
They've got these tall clouds that sort of the precursors to big thunder clouds. And they've had a problem with this before on Apollo 12 in 69. You launch a rocket through that and the plume that comes out the back of your rocket becomes a conductor. So it's like launching a lightning conductor into this proto thunder cloud. So there's the risk of lightning strike. And that actually, I think, is part of what they're keeping their eye on at the moment.
OK, so lovely, fluffy clouds. Not good.
Not good.
Need to move. That aside, is there another, I suppose, risk that people are thinking about between now and launch?
So Between now and launch, there's a lot going on. They're getting the vehicle ready. And you heard Cernan there talk about this is sort of technology and people. It's a system of technology and people. So they're going to fuel up the rocket. They're going to put the propellant on board. But there are still problems also with the weather, because if they the weather has to be good not just above Cape Canaveral, it needs to be good all the way across the Atlantic, across the abort corridor, because if anything goes wrong, they've got to rescue them out of the ocean. So there's a lot of moving parts here. The weather's got to be good, the machine has to be good, the crew have to be good. It's all going to happen in the next 12 hours.
And I suppose, how big is this moment potentially, just to, you know, if you haven't been following the fitful starts and the tests and the trials?
So this is an enormous moment. It's the first time that NASA have put a vehicle up in 15 years. The last shuttle went in 2011. It's the first time we're leaving low Earth orbit since the Apollo era. You know, we're nearly 60 years away from that. And make no mistake, this is a hugely ambitious mission. You're going to fire four people across the void of space between Earth and Moon, 250,000 miles, and then beyond it. And I mean, this is about as risky as it gets. And the broadcaster in me feels the excitement. The doctor in me feels the nervousness of what this takes to do safely. The explorer in me just wants them to go.
And do it.
And do it.
Do you think that feeling is shared? Do you think there is that same excitement, you know, even in the UK?
So it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think in retrospect, everyone thinks that everyone was always really excited about Apollo all the way through. But even when Apollo flew in the 1960s, you know, the polls said that only about half of Americans were really that excited about it, that bothered about it. It's really in retrospect we celebrate it. I think people will get excited when they see this go, when they see the first images from that crew beamed back from the moon, of the moon rolling by their windows. I think that everyone will get it at that point.
We'll see. We will see. time will tell, and we'll have to just watch those clouds and everything else you've outlined. Professor Kevin Fong, thank you.
7:15 is the time.
The war in the Middle East is having many effects, and some now very close to home indeed, with the head of the NHS in England saying he is very concerned about medicine supply issues. The UK imports the majority of its medicine. There's also a concern about supplies and you know, ancillary things that doctors need and equipment. What are the concerns, and what's the level of concern amongst the medicines and pharmaceuticals industries about these supply chain issues? Dr. Leila Hambeck, Chief Executive of the Independent Pharmacies Association, which represents around 5,000 pharmacies across England and Wales, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
When the head of the NHS in England says he's really worried about medicine supply issues because of what's going on in the Middle East, where are you at?
Well, we are very worried about the supply of medicines in the UK in the coming weeks, actually, because, 2 weeks ago, I wrote to the Secretary of State, Wes Streeting, and I highlighted to him the impact of the ongoing war in the Middle East and asked the government to have a clear plan to protect our medicines market. Unfortunately, we haven't heard anything back from the government, or if they have any plans, certainly they haven't shared it with us on the front line. And now, as you said, the head of NHS England is raising concerns too.
You haven't heard back?
No.
Do you usually hear back, or do you never usually write?
Well, when you think about how serious this is, we would have expected that we would hear back in terms of like what their plans are, so that we know on the front line what we're doing. Because obviously, if this war continues, driving up the cost and constraining pharmaceutical ingredients and so on, this will have a major issue for supply chain. We're already seeing cost of medicines going up and pharmacies being out of pocket. So there's got to be plans in place.
So that's what's happening, that the price goes up and the pharmacists are left short.
Yes, of course. So for example, we now have about 300 medicines that cost more than originally were in the drug tariff. And this leaves pharmacists out of pocket when purchasing them. So we've asked the Secretary of State to look at all of this to ensure that there's safeguarding in place, ensuring that medicine supply is added to the register for, you know, national register for risk.
I mean, now that this has been flagged, I suppose, not that your letter shouldn't have had any, should have had a response, of course, but now this has been flagged by the Chief Executive of NHS England, are you, I don't know, more confident that perhaps there will be some kind of plan forthcoming? Do you think that the government doesn't yet have one?
Well, there's got to be decisive actions here, because we are very close to having a crisis if nothing is done. And I'm using the word crisis because right now we are experiencing a lot of problems with medicine supply. And if this war continues, yeah, we will enter in a crisis situation. So it has to be prioritised.
It has to be prioritised. That's a very clear message. But how close are we to crisis?
Very close. It all obviously depends how quickly the costs will rise. And we know everyone within the supply chain is worried about it, from manufacturers to wholesalers to us. So that's why we wanted to be early on writing to the Secretary of State so that they have plans in place and add this to the National Risk Register.
It's not part of the National Risk Register, is that right?
Yeah, well, so far as we know, it's not. But again, communication hasn't been great. We need to know exactly what is happening. People are worried on the front line, but more importantly, we're worried about our patients receiving medicines in a timely manner.
And sorry, just to clarify, when you say we're close to crisis, are you talking days?
We don't know. It all depends on how the prices are going to go up, how the availability of raw ingredients is going to be, and how the delays are going to happen. But we want to make sure that there are plans in place. And we don't want to worry patients at this stage, because obviously as pharmacists, we will do everything we can to ensure that they have their medicines. But the government has to prioritise this and step in and put plans in place and communicate that with us.
When you hear, I mean, this is beyond your brief professionally in the sense of, but you're obviously operating in a context of a very hot geopolitical climate. But when you hear that Trump has talked about the fact that, you know, this will be done within a couple of weeks, whether there's a deal or not, have we got a couple of weeks when it comes to our supplies?
Well, it's the cost of everything going up as well, which means that we are in a situation where we may not be able to compensate purchasing these medicines, but also it comes back to, because a lot of times the messages are quite mixed messages, and for people on the front line like us, every day we read what's going on, it makes us even more worried, and that's why it's important to have those plans,
okay,
guidelines, well, what we need to do.
We'll see what the response is from the government. Dr. Leila Hambeck, Chief Executive of the Independent Pharmacies Association, thank you.
19 minutes past seven is the time. Why was Scott Mills, the Radio 2 presenter, fired? We still don't know. The Sun this morning says the corporation knew that he had been interviewed by the police about what the Sun says were sex offences with a boy under the age of 16. That investigation beginning in 2016. The case then dropped for lack of evidence in 2019. There may, it seems, have been separate allegations as well. Katie Raslar, Culture and Media Editor, is on the line. Bring us up to date, Katie, with where we are.
Well, Justin, I think it's worth saying, I've covered a lot of these stories, these BBC crises as media editor, and it's worth saying at the start, this one is different because the BBC acted swiftly after a review post Hugh Edwards. The message from the top was nobody is irreplaceable. If you don't live BBC values, you are out. So just a reminder, Scott Mills was off air last Wednesday and sacked by the weekend. So that's certainly a different approach from the BBC. But I think we're now in what is called the holding pattern stage of these crises, where the BBC has said nothing about why it sacked him. We only have one line. While we do not comment on matters relating to individuals, we can confirm Scott Mills is no longer contracted to work with the BBC. Meanwhile, other narratives have filled the void. And the latest, as you say, is two reports in different newspapers. The Sun reporting that the BBC kept Scott Mills on air 10 years ago, even though it knew he was being investigated by the police. Now, just a reminder, we had certainly not established that this is connected to the firing, because as I say, the BBC is not saying anything along those lines. But we do know that back in the mid to late 2010s, Scott Mills was investigated by the Metropolitan Police after a referral from Hampshire Police and questioned under caution over allegations of serious sex offences with a teenage boy dating back to the late 90s when Scott Mills was in his mid 20s. We at the BBC, BBC News yesterday, established the boy was under 16. So that Sun story relates to that. and the BBC, the official BBC, the corporate side of things that we at BBC News have to go to, have not commented on that case. The Mirror also has a story, a front page this morning, and it's the Mirror that has been, if you like, leading this news, because they got the original story of Scott Mills being fired. They've got a new front page exclusive today that his sacking was as a result of fresh information the BBC was told last week. But the BBC, again, is not commenting on that. So all we have from the BBC is that one quite stark line, not confirming that Scott Mills is no longer contracted to work with the BBC.
Why does this matter, Katie? Because I think a lot of people listening will be saying, the details of this just don't matter to me. They don't really matter in the longer term in the British media landscape. Why do they matter? Why does it matter so much that the BBC gets this right?
Well, for various reasons. The BBC is the most trusted broadcaster in Britain, and actually, you know, up there around the world. I think the stats are the most trusted news organisation in the world, but you might want to check that, but I'm pretty sure that's true. So trust matters. It needs to be seen to be transparent. It needs to be seen to behave well. And, you know, clearly I have some sympathy for the BBC in this situation, which is that it's, you know, balancing a lot of issues. It's balancing, you know, legal advice that it can't say much because it would be an invasion of Scott Mills's privacy. It would be, you know, open it up potentially to defamation claims. But the issue, I suppose, for me, is having covered a lot of these stories, is the BBC will end up saying more, because it always does, because it gets accused of not being transparent, and more into that void are filled these stories, and then it feels it has to comment. I think it matters because, you know, as I've said to you, the perception of too many scandals is a problem for the BBC. We've talked about this earlier this week on the programme. You know, Tim Davey, the Director General, outgoing Director General, leaves tomorrow. It is his last day. This is a week when you would have expected, the guy would have probably hoped, that the BBC might have been concentrating on some of his successes, and of course there have been lots, but instead, you know, a man who was criticised often by the tabloids and sometimes, you know, by other papers and papers that don't always not have an agenda, sorry, too many double negatives, papers that potentially have an agenda against the BBC, criticising Tim Davey for presiding over a sort of scandal-ridden time at the BBC. And there we have another BBC scandal, BBC crisis unfolding. It's worth saying two things, because, you know, Scott Mills is at the centre of this.
Briefly, Katie.
We have not heard from him. We've approached him several times and we have not heard back.
Okay, Katie Razzle, for the timing at least, thank you.
It's 25 minutes past seven. The price of oil rose by a record amount in March. Sean Farrington's back. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Puts in perspective, doesn't it, looking back over the decades of the price of Brent crude oil. It passed $119 for a barrel of that. It was up more than 60% in the month of March. Neil Atkinson is the former head of oil industry and markets at the International Energy Agency. Neil, morning. The price gets the headlines. What does that mean are the biggest impacts for all the products that we get from oil?
Well, what it means is that because crude oil is costing more, it means that eventually refined products, gasoline, diesel, are going to cost an awful lot more for end users. And we've heard already this morning about the impacts are going to be found in other sectors, including medical supplies. So ultimately, the prices everybody pays for petroleum-derived products and services are going to rise.
Do people necessarily pay them? Have refiners been willing to pay those prices, or do they hold back and increase the risk of shortages?
Well, you know, the problem we've got is that the closure of the Strait of Hormuz means that an enormous amount of oil that would ordinarily flow through to refiners has not happened. It's stopped. And refiners, obviously, to make products, because there's still demand for products, will buy crude as they can. Those prices, unless they have hedging contracts, those prices will have gone up enormously. And therefore, that is passed on to the customers of products. It's inevitable. What we might well see is perhaps what's called demand destruction, where prices rise to such levels for consumers that they cut back. And we have to wait and see if that emerges in the next few weeks as the conflict continues.
Are there lessons you've learned, you know, from your time at the International Energy Agency, when you will have seen prices move quickly, maybe not as much as this in the course of a month, that mean that they have to get on top of right now if you're seeing such a fast rise?
Well, I mean, the International Energy Agency put out a list of suggested policies that governments might want to adopt to manage demand, which involves various forms of rationing, I suppose you could call it, calling on people to drive at lower speeds and various other energy-saving measures.
Has the UK done enough of that?
Well, I don't think, you know, I'm based in Paris, so I'm not seeing what's going on in the UK. But from what I can see in the UK, normal behaviour still seems to be continuing, although there is obviously pressure at the pump. But it may come to this, you know, if this crisis is not resolved within the 1 or 2 weeks that the Trump administration talks about, then we may well find that changes to the patterns of behaviour because of higher prices will happen.
Neil, thank you. Neil Atkinson there. Formerly of the International Energy Agency.
28 minutes past seven. President Trump seems to be suggesting that he might end the war with no deal. He also suggested overnight that a new regime already existed in Iran, an Iranian regime that it was easier to do business with. But he also seemed to suggest that he didn't need to do business with them, that there wasn't necessarily a deal to be done. He also seemed to suggest that the Strait of Hormuz might be secured by other nations, nations other than the USA. Let us talk to our chief international correspondent, Lisa Doucette, who's been monitoring events in the Middle East, but also very aware, of course, of what President Trump has been saying. Quite a lot to unpack there, Lisa.
I think we have to wait. President Trump is using a form of words that he has used many times during this war. Our listeners may remember that even in the first weeks of the war, in one of his first interviews where he signaled what seemed to be a clear sign that the war was, in his exact words, will end very soon. And that became a headline, and the oil prices came down, the markets went up. And then if you actually looked at everything that President Trump said, when the journalist said, well, what do you mean it's going to end very soon? And he said, well, it's just in my mind. I'm not sure it's in anyone else's mind, but it's just in my mind. And I think we should have learned by now, and it seems that the markets are learning by now. I met this week some top finance people from the Middle East, and they were saying that they are learning now. Don't take Trump at his word. Wait to see what happens on the ground. For example, what the Iranians are saying is that if you want to convince us that the war is going to end very soon, and bear in mind that Iran, and one of the many times where President Trump indicated that he was ready to, another phrase he used, was going to be winding up. And we thought, oh, that's a different. He's not saying very soon. He said winding up. Maybe that is much more definitive. The Iranians said the sign for us would be that if you stop sending more troops, some of your command troops that could be involved in a commando operation, whether you stop that, when you stop the preparations for an escalation in this war, then we will be convinced, and perhaps the rest of the world will be convinced, that you are ready to stop the war. Now, there's an added element this time, and is it because President Trump realizes that his words cannot shape the reality anymore, that he's announced that he's going to make a major speech tonight, so that everyone is thinking, oh, this is different, what is he going to say? And of course, bear in mind, too, that he said it's going to end very soon, but he said in 2 to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other questions we have to ask, Justin, is who has President Trump's ear now? In the Israeli media this morning, there are reports, analyses, speculation based on unnamed officials, as is always the case, that Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is not ready to end the war. The Gulf states are troubled, not having wanted this war. Now they see a war in which perhaps it could be ended without sorting out the Strait of Hormuz. There's been reports that they wanted at least there to be an end to this war, which ends the war. So I think we really, really have to use that great expression, let's wait and see.
OK, fair advice. We're going to hear from a Trump advisor, or a former Trump advisor, actually, at 10 to 8, who suggests that whatever Donald Trump says about the Strait of Hormuz, it would, in his view, be impossible for him politically to leave and for the Strait of Hormuz still to be effectively closed to international shipping. So that is a view from sort of within the Trump camp that slightly contradicts what the president himself has been saying. But anyway, for the time being, Lise Doucette, thank you.
It's 28 minutes to 8. We're going to come to the sport a little bit later than normal, around 27. So now let me tell you that William Crawley's here with some details of the moral maze coming up on Radio 4 this evening.
Today, humanity reaches towards the moon once more, the first crewed lunar mission in more than 50 years. But as NASA's Artemis 2 lifts off, troubling moral questions follow in its wake. Are billions of pounds of visionary investment in our future, or a luxury we cannot afford, while poverty, disease and a climate crisis demand urgent action here on Earth? Is there really a moral imperative to explore the possibility of living on other planets? And as we venture outwards, do we risk repeating the mistakes of colonial expansion? Tonight's Moral Maze, the ethics of reaching for the stars, after the news at 8.
Yes, and I should say it's going to be coming up the sport at 20 to 8. The morality of getting that wrong, I apologise.
Look at the weather. It's going to be cloudy in the north. There'll be a band of rain. It will clear to showers later. It will be dry with variable cloud further south.
And after the news, we're going to be hearing from the business secretary, Peter Kyle. If you own a business, listen carefully to that. You'll be told what the government is doing to help firms weather the coming energy crunch and rising costs.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Justin Webb. The time is 27 minutes to 8, and Jane Steele has the news.
President Trump has said the US military operation in Iran could end very soon, suggesting it may take 2 or 3 weeks to, in his words, finish the job. Mr. Trump said such a move would bring fuel prices tumbling down. He's due to make a televised address about the war tonight. There have been reports of strikes on part of the Iranian capital, Tehran. Elsewhere, a tanker near Qatar has been hit by an unknown projectile, while Iranian drones have hit Kuwait's international airport. Israel's military says it has carried out 2 separate strikes targeting senior members of Hezbollah in Beirut. It hasn't identified them or said whether or not they were killed. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that possible government support to help people to pay their energy bills may not be available until the autumn. She told the BBC that if required, the measures would take into account household income. Increases in the mandatory national living wage for nearly 2.7 million workers have come into force. The hourly pay for employees over the age of 21 will go up by 50 pence to £12.71. Those aged 18 to 20 will see their hourly pay rise by 85 pence to £10.85. The NHS in England is to prescribe the weight loss drug Wegovy to more than 1 million overweight patients at risk of heart attacks and strokes. Data showed the drug reduced such medical emergencies by 20% when used alongside standard medicines such as statins. The NHS has described it as a life-changing treatment option. A 2-hour launch window opens later tonight in which NASA's mission to the moon could take off. The project is the first of its kind in more than 50 years. Artemis 2 is attempting to send 4 astronauts on a 10-day journey around the moon and back. If successful, the mission would break the record for the furthest any astronauts have travelled from Earth.
Jane, thank you. It's 25 minutes to 8. As you were just hearing there, help is coming today with the cost of living. That is the government's message, at least, because of those increases that James was talking about to the national living wage kicking in from today, April 1st. Excuse me, that boost announced last November, of course, before the energy price shock hit the world over the last month. While it will still be welcome news to many workers, business leaders are fearing the wage increases will push up costs, potentially prices, and to the point that businesses, especially in the hospitality sector, are at the risk at the moment of going under, all of which we need to explore with the Business and Trade Secretary, who joins me now, Peter Kyle. Good morning.
Hi, Emma.
The rise to the living wage, if you just look at one area of business, for instance, hospitality, a new survey led by Hospitality UK, that members group, shows two-thirds of hospitality businesses are now planning job cuts as a result of, quote, suffocating costs imposed by your government as those new business rates and higher wage bills come into force. That's hardly good news. It's not great to get a pay rise if you no longer have a job.
Well, we know that there are stresses and strains in the economy. That's why we've been getting a grip on the public finances. It's why we've been getting growth into the economy. And if you look at the statistics and the measurements going into the spring statement, we have a growing economy, we have growing productivity, we have record investment into the economy. These are things which ultimately puts money into people's pockets and gets them out there spending in communities. That's the fundamental way of getting hospitality and every other business in our country thriving.
But the point is whether you've got the balance right. And that is not right, according to what I have just read to you. The Resolution Foundation think tank, to add further grist to the mill, says that the impact on hiring young people, you're going to be doing more harm than good. If you look at this raise, the Resolution Foundation say the increase for 18 to 20 year olds is unnecessarily big and could make it harder for people in that age group to find a job. The jobless rate for young people right now is at the worst level for more than a decade.
So the question is how we move through difficult times. So if you flip the question you're asking to the other side, it's shall we get through a challenging period in the economy by screwing down wages and making sure that people on lower incomes pay the highest price? I don't think that is how we as a country want to get through challenging times. We need to get through challenging times by making sure we protect everyone and that everyone can earn a living that actually puts food on the plates of people, whatever their income scale.
But you also need to be reactive to the world events, don't you?
And I am reactive to the world events, which is why I've launched two schemes for cracking down on energy costs for energy intensive industries and the sectors, the manufacturing sectors around the country.
I was asking you about the living wage, and you've gone ahead with this, and businesses, as I've just shared with you, I won't keep sharing different areas and different industries, are saying one thing and you are saying another, and you sound rather tin-eared to them, don't you?
No, I'm not tin-eared to it, which is why I've been acting so much in other circumstances. We need to get a grip on the public finances so we have a growing economy.
Well, we need business owners to feel like they've got faith in a government.
And they have a faith in a government, they should do, with a government that actually get a grip on public finances, has the fundamentals of running the economy right. And of course, even though we are facing more challenges that will stem from the war in the Middle East, we're having a more resilient economy.
Hey, business leaders have faith in this government. I'll play you a clip in a moment from Lord Harrington. Yes, a former Conservative MP, but now the chair of Make UK. The very first thing he said was that the businesses he represents do not have faith in this government. You're not a pro-business government, as you went round touting pre-election, are you?
Well, Emma, if you look at business sentiment by the CBI, it's increased 28% since December. If you look at Mate UK, who represents the manufacturing sector, more than 65% of their members are optimistic about the future. So, look, Emma...
Hang on, that's a completely different statistic to what Lord Harrington said at the beginning of the interview.
No,
you
I realise.
You can go back and listen. He should know. He is the chair of that body and he's there to represent them. If you talk about... if you actually sort of answer the questions that are being asked here, you're answering with what makes this government look like it's in a good position when it comes to business. You're not engaging. When I say to you, it's suffocating from the hospitality industry, they don't want to sack people. They don't want to close pubs. They don't want to close hotels. But this is what they're saying. Are you not worried you've taken the wrong decisions at the right time?
I am absolutely confident that we are taking the fundamental decisions about the overall running of the economy that will make sure that we have an economy where we have people who can spend money in the economy, because what you're talking about is government subsidies to businesses. We need an economy which is a healthy, organically growing economy where people can go and spend money and then recycle it into the economy.
I've not even come onto energy. You've just brought up government subsidies.
I didn't mention energy then.
No, but you've brought up subsidies, and I'm going to come onto energy because it's important to bring up. You've already raised it and I want to get to it. But you've brought up subsidies. I've brought up your decision to raise the living wage. That's what I was talking about right from the beginning, because that's happening today. And you didn't need to do that. And you know, there are people asking, what on earth is the point of coming to meet the Prime Minister, for instance? Energy and business voices gathered with the Prime Minister for a round table around the, you know, these costs and particularly around energy. And, you know, these talks by some have been called performative, and you don't have any support, for instance, on energy. Let's get to that now. Even though you've talked about households, what are you going to do?
I'm just going to answer the accusation that you put to me. Yes, it is choices. I'm not resiling from the fact that I'm making choices in this job. I choose not to rebalance our economy and survive difficult times by screwing down on low-paid workers. I want to make sure that people can earn a living in our economy, whether they're on low-paid or high-paid jobs.
So you're choosing workers over businesses. That's very clear from what you've just said.
I believe...
If businesses are then going to fire a load of people, that won't feel very good to those workers because they'll be unemployed. Well, that's the argument from business.
Well, productivity has started rising for the first time in 13 years because we are actually investing in the workforce, bringing more rights into the economy and making sure that people have things like sick pay from day one where they didn't have before. These are things that give people security in the workforce, make them more productive in the workforce and create healthier businesses, more productive business, more profitable businesses into the long term. I'm not going to resile from making these decisions, but at the same time, we're getting a grip on the public finances, getting growth into the economy. Of course, will be challenged by the issues going on in the Middle East. But having those that resilience in the economy gives us the foundations to build upon. I am not going to progress our country and have it moving forward on the back of screwing down on low-paid workers in difficult times. I'm going to take them with us and invest in them and make sure that they can enjoy and look forward to a life that gets better year after year. That they can look forward to perhaps even buying capital assets like cars and homes and investing in things like education, where before we've inherited an economy where if you are in work, then quite often you are in poverty. The last Labour government, most poverty was worklessness, where we inherited an economy where most people who live in poverty were in work.
Peter
I'm not
Kyle,
going to allow that to
Peter
go forward
Kyle,
in that way.
We have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Peter Kyle, Business and Trade Secretary.
It is, 16 minutes to 8, which is rather late for the sport, but nonetheless, it's always worth waiting for when it's Mike.
This will be worth the wait, Justin. Yes, got something special for you here, but let's reflect first, shall we, on a couple of underwhelming friendly defeats for England and Scotland last night at Wembley. Thomas Tuchel made 10 changes, and that showed as England were beaten 1-0 by Japan. Harry Kane rested for that one on the bench after picking up a knock in training. Scotland were also beaten 1-0 by the Ivory Coast in a friendly, and in Cardiff, Wales drew 1-1 with Northern Ireland. The big headline from World Cup qualifying last night saw four-time world champions Italy fail to reach a third straight World Cup after a penalty shootout defeat to Bosnia-Herzegovina. There will be one English manager at the World Cup this summer, though. Graham Potter's Sweden beat Poland in Stockholm to book their place at the tournament. And as we were mentioning last hour, the final team to qualify for the World Cup, securing the very last place at the tournament in the last 90 minutes or so, was Iraq. They beat Bolivia 2-1 in an intercontinental playoff out in Mexico. This was the moment in Arabic that Iraq booked their place at the World Cup for the first time since 1986.
ثانيا مختلفا 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 يا عراق كره تلعب الله الله مبروك للعرب ما فعلته العراق مبروك انجاز العراق.
Iraqi jubilation in Monterey, and I promised you last hour that we would try and speak to one Iraqi fan, and I've tracked him down. Delighted to say we can speak to Hassan Bilal, host of the Iraq Football Podcast, British Iraqi who has made the journey out to Mexico to watch his nation make history. You were at the match, Hassan. How was it? Iraq are going to the World Cup.
There's no words to describe this, mate. This is one of my biggest dreams in my life. Against all odds, recent events in the Middle East have been really, really tough. Players have had to go through a very tumultuous journey, but it doesn't matter. We're going to the World Cup. I'm so happy for everyone back home, you know? It's been really difficult recently, and they finally have something to look forward to. Us Iraqis, unfortunately, in the media, we're often portrayed negatively, but we're associated with Saddam Hussein, with the 2003 invasion, ISIS, terrorism. No one really in the way, the beautiful side of Iraq, the dancing, the partying, the food, the football. Now we get to go it's all to the world. Hopefully the world can see what Iraq is really about and why we deserve to be there. This is where we belong.
And just tell us about the atmosphere inside the stadium. Were there many Iraqi fans there?
To be honest with you, when I booked my ticket, I thought it would genuinely be me and a couple of hundreds. The stadium was packed to the brim with Iraqi fans. Couldn't believe it when I went in. I thought it was all going to be Bolivians. No, the Iraqi fans here, we've made Iraq proud. Unfortunately, people back home couldn't make it here financially, logistically. So the diaspora has took charge. They've all made their way over from Europe, from Canada, from the US.
And how will they do at the World Cup, Hassan? What group are they going in, and what chance do you give them of causing more upsets at this tournament?
Our group is France, Norway, Senegal. So I think it will be strange to tell you I'm optimistic of winning the group and the World Cup. But this is a huge achievement to qualify for the World Cup, because now that barrier, that burden's been lifted off their shoulders of having never qualified. The World Cup is going to be brilliant. Even if we lose three games, it doesn't matter. But that's not to say we will lose. We will go. I know these players are going to go out there and they're going to work hard and they're going to make the country proud. This means everything. We've had to suffer a lot, unfortunately, these last few decades. The players suffered under US sanctions in the 90s. The early 2000s saw the US invasion and the sectarian violence that followed. Then in the 2010s, we saw ISIS take over. These players have suffered immensely. The fans have suffered immensely. But football in Iraq is incredible, because people of all backgrounds, all ethnicities, all religions, all sects, there you will see Iraqis together, side by side, celebrating. I promise you, tomorrow, it's a national holiday in Iraq. No one is going to be doing anything but celebrating. I can't believe this. It's one of the best days of my life.
That is one happy Iraqi fan. Hassan Bilal, the host of the Iraq Football Podcast, out in Mexico after his side qualified for the World Cup this summer.
Mike, thank you for that. 12 minutes to 8 is the time. Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning here in the studio is the Senior Rabbi of Masorti Judaism, Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg. Good morning.
Good morning. Tonight is Seder night, the start of Passover, the Jewish festival of freedom, when we recall the exodus from Egypt, our people's journey from slavery to liberation. It's a story which embraces all our stories. My mother, aged 100, tells how she escaped Nazi Europe. A woman whose husband is imprisoned in the Congo says, "May God who freed your people free him." A Muslim guest who fled for his life stands up and exclaims, "Your story is my story too." For, far from free, so much of the world suffers beneath oppression and war. Maybe that's why the Seder ends with a song, Chad Gadya, which means one little goat in Aramaic. It's a ditty in the style of the house that Jack built. A cat eats the goat, dog bites cat, stick hits dog, fire burns stick, water quenches fire, cow drinks water, butcher kills cow. Then the angel of death dispatches the butcher. But finally, God comes and slays the angel of death. I have a vivid memory of my grandfather, aged and weak, catching my eye and whispering at what he knew would be his last Seder. After death comes God. That was his faith, his hope. But does God have the last word in our violent world? It hardly feels that way today. I phone family in Jerusalem. We're in and out of bomb shelters. My heart goes out to them. I call an Iranian friend. No word from my sister in Tehran. My hometown's just been bombed, a Ukrainian acquaintance texts me. So that Chad Gadya song feels like a metaphor for history, only it's not goats and cats, but humanity who's the victim. In their heart-rending shared memorial service, bereaved Israeli and Palestinian families sing that song in Hebrew and Arabic together. Yet I still see my grandfather's face and hear his whisper, "After the angel of death comes God. Life is greater than death." But I hear those words as a question. What world is this? What do we want it to be? Of death or life? Oppression or freedom? Cruelty or compassion? I pray this Passover will truly mark our journey towards freedom, so that we can celebrate God's world together, knowing that the same sacred spirit flows through us all, whatever our faith or nationality, giving life to all that breathes. We've had too much of cat eating goat, human devouring human. May this festival of freedom mark our liberation from hatred, violence and fear for my people and every people.
That was Thought for the Day with Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg. The time, 9 minutes to 8.
Donald Trump is going to address Americans live on TV tonight and tell them what. It seems he's going to say that the war is going to end soon. At a press conference at the Oval Office last night, the president suggested it would be over in a matter of weeks.
We're negotiating with them right now. They've been, again, we have had regime change. Now, regime change was not one of the things I had as a goal. I had one goal. They will have no nuclear weapon. And that goal has been attained. They will not have nuclear weapons. But we're finishing the job. And I think within maybe 2 weeks, maybe a couple of days longer to do the job.
Well, as he was talking, it was being reported in the Wall Street Journal that the UAE might join military action to secure and open the Strait of Hormuz to international shipping, but with no details of how that would happen. Also worth mentioning, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, has been suggesting that the US commitment to NATO might itself have to be re-examined. If NATO is simply about having troops in Europe to defend Europe, but when we need them to allow us to use their military bases, their answer is no, then why are we in NATO? He asked on American television. Sam Nunberg was political advisor to Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. When I talked to him, we began with the war, which he believes is a success.
If the U.S. and Israel were to stop this campaign today, I do not see how Iran could rebuild their arsenal by the time President Trump were to leave office. So to me, that's an immediate victory. The only issue now is with the Strait of Hormuz. And I do not think Donald Trump is going to stop this campaign or war, whatever you like to call it, until the Strait of Hormuz is under the control of some kind of international body.
Oh, that's interesting, because he seems to suggest at some stages that he might just go, and it's up to the rest of the world. In fact, he said it expressly, didn't he? The rest of the world can go there and secure it if they want to. You think that won't actually be the case?
No, I do not. I think that that's probably posturing by him in order to see if he can have our allies in NATO, who frankly have not been helpful at all. This is a larger issue. If you look at what Secretary of State Rubio said on all media channels of Al Jazeera, where he said that the U.S. may have to reevaluate its relationship with NATO. I mean, you have people like me who have constantly thought that Donald Trump was too hard on NATO and didn't like the way he went about criticizing it publicly. And then I see that, you know, we can't get assistance from your country, from Britain or from France or anyone else on something along the lines of a mission against one of the most dangerous countries in the world that was a threat, as your government would well know, had already been caught lying when they tried to bomb Diego Air Base, that they claimed that they did not have intercontinental ballistic capabilities that could hit there. That's already double the amount that they publicly declared that their missiles could go in range. So the issue is that there's a report now in the Wall Street Journal that the UAE has already agreed to join fighting with the U.S. to open up the Hormuz. I'm sure Israel will assist, and Saudi Arabia. So the real issue is going to be if Europe and NATO want to be left behind on this.
But isn't the other issue, though, whether it can militarily be done?
From my understanding, the issue isn't necessarily the mines or the strait itself. The issue is Karg Island. I am not an expert on this, but that would result in American losses. You know, that's door-to-door combat there. Now, when you talk about the losses America could take, sure, it would be a terrible tragedy. That is a dilemma that's facing the president, and that's his decision. But I could tell you that this cannot end at some kind of standstill where the United States and Israel, you know, hit 10,000-plus targets, but Iran is able to control the Strait of Hormuz. That's really unsustainable.
But if Donald Trump does what you suggest he is likely to do, the problem for him back at home is the direct opposite, isn't it, of all that he said he was going to bring to the United States and to the world. In other words, not to involve the United States in wars, etc., etc. It is the direct opposite.
Well, first of all, when he said wars, it was very clear what he meant was nation building. At the end of the day, Donald Trump has not said that he cares if there's free and fair elections held in Iran. At the end of the day, he has not said whether or not he wants protesters to be in control once he decides to end the military campaign. We're not going in there to build schools and roads, okay? In fact, we may even be bombing the rest of their roads across Tehran in a couple weeks. So that's really what that meant. Now, it was a criticism of the Iraq war and the way the Iraq war was handled. That's why he has the support of the Republican Party. When you look at the polling, he has 90+% support of self-described MAGA Republicans, over 85% support of the Republican Party. And independents are not in support of the war, but it's over 60% that they view Iran as a threat itself. So I would say that that goes obviously to the economic ramifications of this campaign. So you can't look at this in a total type of vacuum. And the issue is, we're only a month into this. I'll speak to you 7 months from now if we're still involved. And when I say we, I mean the United States. I'd be very surprised and dismayed. And you can play that back to me. I don't suspect that the United States will be continuing this fight within 4 months or so. But I also don't believe that the timetable that the president has said, I don't suspect that this will be over within the next month either.
Final thought, what's the state of the relationship with the UK at the moment? Because Pete Hegseth, the Secretary for War, made fun of the Royal Navy. Donald Trump has been openly quite hostile to Keir Starmer. And yet there is about to be a royal visit. Can all this be patched up or maybe not?
President Trump is an Anglophile at heart, and he loves the UK. You see that even with the first trade deal that he made. And I was actually quite surprised, pleasantly surprised, that he gets along with Keir Starmer. I thought that that would be a fraught relationship, especially during his first term. He had difficult relationships with Tory prime ministers. So this goes more into, I wouldn't look at it as a relationship with the UK per se. I would look at it in a relationship with NATO, and I do think that there will be major ramifications. I suspect, regardless of whether or not the UK, France, and or Germany come to assist the US and other allies in a campaign to open up Hormuz, for instance, I think Spain is going to be kicked out. I don't know how the president will do it, but certainly something like Spain, he'll want to get kicked out of NATO.
Sam Nombo, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
And now we can get the latest from Stav Danaeus on the weather.
Thanks very much, Emma and Justin. Good morning to you. Yesterday was a mild day. We saw temperatures reach 21 degrees in Pershore in Worcestershire, making it the warmest day of the year so far for England, matching Wales's 21 degrees back on the 18th of March. Now we're into April. England and Wales Day will see a similar picture with variable cloud and some sunny spells, probably more cloud around today than what we had yesterday. So that might impact the temperature slightly. 12 to 15 degrees is still pretty respectable for this time of year, to a few degrees above normal. Scotland, Northern Ireland, just starting off mainly dry, but you'll start to see rain pushing down from the northwest as a weather front moves in. That'll bring a wetter afternoon for both Scotland and Northern Ireland. Some of the rain heavy across western Scotland. As that rain pushes further southwards, skies may brighten for Northern Ireland, western Scotland, with a few sunny spells, a few scattered showers as well, but a cooler day to come, 7 to 13 Celsius.
Stav, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 1st of April. The headlines. President Trump is to make a televised address this evening about the war in Iran after suggesting that US attacks could end very soon, regardless of whether there is a peace deal. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that any government help with household energy bills will not happen until the autumn. And the weight loss drug Wegovy is to be prescribed on the NHS in England for more than 1 million patients at risk of heart disease. We'll talk to a government advisor about that move, which is a big change of direction in some ways, at 20 past eight.
And coming up in the next hour, we'll hear straight after the news from one of the astronauts chosen to go on that 10-day sweep around the moon.
We know from the shuttle days, they create a lot of vibration. They're a very rumbly ride. But the big thing is we won't know if that's normal. As this thing vibrates itself and you're like, is it coming apart or is this okay? Like, there's nobody to ask.
And as Apple turns 50 today, what makes it so successful?
Every company in the world claims that they strive for excellence, but Apple
its culture is really something different. It is very intense there. And when they say they strive for excellence, I mean, they go miles out of their way.
The news is read this morning by Jane Steele.
President Trump says the US attacks on Iran could end very soon and indicated a timeline of 2 or 3 weeks. Speaking at the White House, Mr. Trump said such a move would bring fuel prices tumbling down. He's due to deliver a televised address to the nation about Iran tonight. The price of Brent crude has fallen by almost 4% to around $100 a barrel. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
This is President Trump's clearest signal since the war began that he intends to end it soon, having achieved his goals. He'd previously urged Iran to negotiate, and while he said Tehran was now begging for a deal, he insisted it wasn't necessary to stop military operations.
No, they don't have to make a deal with me. When we feel that they are, for a long period of time, put into the Stone Ages and they won't be able to come up with a nuclear weapon, then we'll leave. Whether we have a deal or not, it's irrelevant.
He said Iran now had new leaders who were much more accessible, much less radicalized, and more rational compared with their predecessors. For his part, Iran's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has said Tehran has the necessary will to end the war with the United States and Israel, provided certain conditions are met, including guarantees that there would be no return to conflict. His comments were carried by Iranian state media, but it's unclear how much authority they carry within Iran's leadership.
Explosions were heard across the Iranian capital, Tehran, overnight. Israel says it carried out what it called a wide-scale wave of strikes on the city. Gulf states have also been coming under attack, as our correspondent Katie Watson reports from Doha.
As airstrikes on Iran continue, several states across the Gulf have reported yet more attacks overnight. A Bangladeshi national was killed by falling shrapnel from a drone in Fujairah in the UAE. Fuel depots at Kuwait's international airport were hit by drones, causing a huge fire. And here in Qatar, close to Ras Laffan, the country's major liquefied natural gas facility that was attacked earlier this month, a tanker was hit by two unknown projectiles. One caused a small fire. Another remains unexploded in the tanker's engine room and is being investigated. Saudi Arabia and Bahrain have also reported attacks. Gulf leaders aren't saying much right now. Their main focus is on defending their territory. But countries in the region have made it clear they want an end to the war and an end to the uncertainty that comes with this conflict.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that any possible government support to help people with their energy bills may not arrive until the autumn. In an interview with BBC Breakfast, she said the Treasury was working on a range of contingencies. Our business correspondent Peter Ruddick reports.
Energy bills for more than half of households in England, Scotland and Wales will fall from today thanks to a lower level in the Ofgem price cap. However, that cap is expected to jump significantly when reset in July. Rachel Reeves has previously said any help with bills, if needed, would be targeted. But now she's given the BBC more details.
It will be really from the autumn onwards that people's gas usage starts increasing. So at the moment, we're working on a range of contingencies and we are looking at more targeted measures. We're looking at ways in which we can support people based on their household income.
With prices already rising at the pumps, the government's also facing calls to follow other countries and cut taxes on petrol and diesel. The Chancellor said she had to be careful with promises to lower prices for everyone because it risked pushing up inflation, interest rates and taxes in the future.
The Conservatives and Reform UK want VAT to be removed from energy bills to help households. The Liberal Democrats say the link between gas prices and energy costs should be broken, while the Green Party is calling for higher taxes, including on capital gains, to keep bills down. In Scotland, the SNP says the price cap shouldn't be allowed to rise because of the war. Plaid Cymru wants broader direct support for households in Wales. The NHS in England is to prescribe the weight loss drug Wegovy to more than a million overweight patients at risk of heart attacks and strokes. The health watchdog NICE says the drug offers an extra layer of protection. The NHS has described it as a life-changing treatment option. Our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson reports.
The drug is one of the GLP-1 semaglutides, which are already used by the NHS for weight loss and diabetes. Clinical data from the SELECT trial showed the drug reduced heart attacks and strokes by 20% when used alongside standard medicines such as statins. Interestingly, benefits were seen before people had lost significant amounts of weight, suggesting it works directly on the heart and blood vessels. Eligible patients will be prescribed Wegovy from this summer, now that a deal has been struck between the NHS and its manufacturer, Novo Nordisk.
A Russian military transport plane has crashed in Crimea, killing 29 passengers and crew on board. The country's defence ministry has blamed a technical malfunction. It said the aircraft had flown into a cliff. Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. The Ukrainian authorities haven't commented on the crash. A man has been charged after seven people were injured in Derby at the weekend when a car drove onto a pavement. Sandhu Ponachan, who's 36 and from the city, will appear in court later. Three people remain in hospital. Here's Aruna Iyengar.
Sandhu Ponachan was arrested shortly after the incident and was held for questioning before being charged last night. He's accused of six counts of grievous bodily harm with intent, as well as attempted GBH with intent, dangerous driving and possession of a bladed article. Police are again asking the public to come forward with information about what happened, including footage from CCTV, dash cams or mobile phones. They say the incident has sent shockwaves through Derby and the county as a whole. Counter-terrorism officers initially joined the investigation, but police have since said that it is not being treated as terrorism.
Pressure is mounting on the BBC after two newspapers made fresh claims in relation to the sacking of the Radio 2 breakfast presenter Scott Mills. The reports involve a Metropolitan Police investigation from 2018, which examined historical allegations of serious sexual offences relating to a teenage boy who was under 16. Scott Mills has not said anything publicly since he was fired. More from our culture correspondent Noonanji.
The Sun says that according to a source, Scott Mills told the BBC he had been questioned by police and that he had denied the claims against him. The paper says that managers allowed him to continue working while the police investigated. In a separate report, The Mirror claimed that his sacking was the result of fresh information that the BBC was told last week. The BBC declined to comment on both of these stories. So far, the corporation has given few details, but the questions are mounting over what it may or may not have known at the time and what led to the sudden departure of the Radio 2 DJ. No charges were brought against Scott Mills after prosecutors in 2019 decided there was insufficient evidence to proceed with the case. Scott Mills has not responded to multiple requests for comment.
NASA officials say a mission to the moon is on track ahead of a possible launch tonight. Artemis 2 is attempting to send four astronauts on a 10-day journey around the moon and back. If the trip is successful, they will break the record for the furthest any astronauts have travelled from Earth. Our science editor Rebecca Morell sent this report from the Kennedy Space Centre in Florida.
After years of work and delays along the way, NASA's Artemis 2 mission is finally nearing its launch. The 98-metre-tall moon rocket will be filled with millions of litres of explosive fuel, ready to be ignited at the end of the countdown. The four Artemis astronauts will get into their bright orange flight suits about 5.5 hours before the planned liftoff, and then head to the launch pad, ready to be strapped into their seats at the very top of the rocket. There's a 2-hour launch window which opens late tonight. NASA will be hoping for no technical problems and clear weather in Cape Canaveral so they can get their astronauts on their way to the moon.
The golfer Tiger Woods has said he intends to seek treatment and concentrate on his health after a car crash in Florida last week. He was arrested and court documents show the 15-time major champion has pleaded not guilty to driving under the influence. Woods said he recognised the seriousness of the situation he found himself in and that he wanted to return in a healthier, stronger and more focused place.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. This is what Reid Weissman, the 50-year-old commander of the Artemis 2 mission to the moon, said to his two teenage daughters. Here's where the will is. Here's where the trust documents are. And if anything happens to me, here's what's going to happen to you. Mr. Weissman is a single parent. His wife died of cancer years ago. His words to his daughters are a reminder that going into space is a risk. Space is not a safe space. It is the opposite. And yet those who are enthusiasts for exploration say the risks to individuals are worth taking. And there are gains for us all, some tangible, some not so tangible. So tonight, another step is to be taken. Back to the moon via the very much delayed launch of the Artemis II craft. Not to walk on it, but to fly past, and to fly beyond as well, over to the dark side of the moon, further than anyone has previously been. Jeremy Hansen from the Canadian Space Agency is one of the four astronauts who's been talking to Rebecca Morrell and Tim Peake on the BBC's Space podcast, 13 Minutes. He told them about what he's expecting the launch to be like.
Yeah, when it comes to riding the rocket, what is really kind of fun to think about is we don't exactly know what to expect. Yes, the vehicle has flown once with no humans on it and data was collected, but the vehicle is slightly different. Things have changed and nothing really captures the full experience. We don't imagine anyway. And you've got these solid rocket boosters. We know from the shuttle days, the people who flew shuttle, they are just real. They create a lot of vibration. They're a very rumbly ride. But the big thing is we won't know if that's normal. I think, you know, coming as this thing vibrates itself and you're like, is it coming apart or is this okay? Like there's nobody to ask that what it's going to exactly feel like. And so we're just going to have faith that whatever we're experiencing is probably normal unless we're convinced it's not. The things I'm really excited to see, even in the first 45 minutes of this flight, we fly out to probably close to 2,000 kilometers from the planet. The International Space Station's about 400. So we get some pretty extraordinary views even in that first 45 minutes. And those will be my first views of the planet from space. I'll see it go from pretty close to all, you know, pretty far away. And then within 12 hours, we're going to be basically out at 60,000 kilometers from the planet. That'll be extraordinary. And then as we'll fly around the moon over 400,000 kilometers away and look back at the planet in the background of a lunar foreground, which I think will be an extraordinary human experience. And I hope humanity will stop for a moment when four humans are on the far side of the moon and just look at some of the imagery that we are sharing and just be reminded that we can do a better job as humans of just lifting each other up, not destroying, but creating together. Maybe when I get back and we're hugging each other as a crew, maybe it'll sink in then.
You have a full interview on tonight's episode of 13 Minutes. You can find it on BBC Sounds. Dr. Barbara Cohen is a NASA project scientist for Artemis 4, which is one of the next two missions, both of them due to launch in 2028. She told us why this mission, Artemis 2, is so exciting for the progression of science.
Well, as you know, Artemis 2 is the first time that we'll be sending crew, humans, beyond low Earth orbit in over 50 years. We haven't done this since the Apollo missions, and the last one in 1972. So it is extremely exciting for us to be able to send crew. As a scientist, I'm excited because the human eye and the human brain and the human hands are the most sophisticated scientific instruments that I can think of. And so having the opportunity to of these people conduct science, train for science, conduct science, really figure out how to infuse science into this enterprise is just very gratifying.
We're pretty depressed, a lot of us, about the state of humanity at the moment. What does it do for humanity?
All the enterprise that we do to advance science and technology, those are things that pay benefits to societies here on Earth. So, of course, there's many ways that societies invest in trying to bring returns to their citizens and to the world. We advance medical knowledge. We advance things like the internet. The things that space does for us is really pushes our technology in things like life support systems. Hopefully those will come back to us as our climate changes and people want to live in more inhospitable environments. We might want better climate control. We might want ways to recycle water in more useful ways as we make scientific advancements and we push our boundaries further and further. A lot of those technologies, things like sensors and manipulators, they come back to us in things like medical fields and allow us to do better diagnostics. So space is exciting for a lot of reasons, but really it's got a very practical bent to it in terms of trying to advance our technologies and advance our industries to be able to pay these multiple dividends.
Take us to the second of the leaps that you're involved with, the leap that actually gets back onto the moon. What is planned?
The next several missions after Artemis II will continue to test first in the system. We're eventually trying to build up a lunar base that's much like a research base. Many nations maintain research bases all over the world in inhospitable environments, say Antarctica. That's what we're leading up to because that'll give us a base from which we can find resources. We can understand the geology of the moon. We can understand the processes that are happening. You don't have to bring everything with you every time. So that's what we're building toward. And we're taking this stepwise approach where on Artemis 1, we tested the rocket and the capsule. On Artemis 2, we're testing the crew and their ability to work in that capsule. Artemis 3, we'll be rendezvousing with our landers and docking with them in Earth orbit. And Artemis 4 and beyond will really be landing on the surface. So as we get comfortable with each of these systems, as we test them out, we can then turn our attention to testing out the new parts of the system and building out the whole thing.
And how does that step then lead to Mars?
Mars is really far away. So Mars is our horizon goal at NASA. That's something where we want humans to explore. Taking the knowledge base that we have from Apollo, being able to go to the moon and come back safely, from 25 years of the International Space Station, being able to live off planet, being able to routinely service and have humans living there for 25 years, taking that to the moon is the next step in trying to expand onto another planet, expand that knowledge base. And all of that together will collectively feed forward into taking the next leap. Mars is very far away. It takes 6 months to get there and 6 months to get back. It'll be about a two-year mission when you're there. We'll be out of contact for long periods of time. There won't be instantaneous communication. We'll have to bring everything with them. So it's a big endeavor. And instead of just jumping straight to that big endeavor, we're going to learn to walk before we learn to run.
But the way you talk about that endeavor is that it will happen. You seem really confident, and I'm not going to ask you to put a date on it, but it will happen.
That's my hope. That is one of the reasons why I enjoy working for this agency so much, is that we always have those goals in mind. We never have the end to itself. It's never just one mission and then we're done. As scientists, what we know is that we are always learning more. Every time we learn something, it closes one question, but it opens up 10 new questions. All of the rovers, the orbiters we have around Mars, not just the US, but multiple nations, all of the science that we're getting from Mars is pointing it to be a really interesting planet. It's got geology like we do, but it evolved in a really different way. So how are the Earth and Mars similar? How are they divergent from each other? Tells us a lot about the solar system and about our origins.
I was asking you earlier on about what this does for humanity, which, of course, is one way of looking at it. But the other way of looking at it is it's very much human competition in space, isn't it? Are you aware of the Chinese also planning the same things? Is it something that you factor in? Do you need to be first? How does that space race, as it used to be called, work in the modern era?
Well, speaking as a scientist, the things that are most important to us are that the science questions get answered. So, for example, the Chinese were the first to bring back samples from the lunar far side and from a place called the South Pole Aiken Basin, which is something that I've personally worked for many decades, and I couldn't celebrate it more. The fact that they did that means we have those samples and we can get those answers. So you're right, there is a nationalistic bent to a lot of programs, including the space program, the human space program. But as a scientist, I'm thrilled when anyone can accomplish some of those science goals. It moves the whole entire science field forward, and then we can take the next steps. We don't have to do the same thing over and over.
Barbara Kern, pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see what happens this evening. It is now 20 past eight. More than a million people with heart diseases are to be offered weight loss injections on the NHS, and a major shift in how the condition is treated. Experts say prescribing the weight loss drug Wegovy to prevent heart attacks and strokes is a win-win and could mark a major turning point in tackling obesity. But But will the gamble pay off? How soon will we know? Professor Naveed Sattar is the chair of the Obesity Healthcare Goals Programme for the government. And we're also going to be talking to Professor Riaz Patel, Professor of Cardiology at UCL and Barts Heart Centre. Welcome to you both and good morning. But first, to come to you, Professor Naveed Sattar, when we are hearing of this kind of change of direction or look, what do you make of the description of this as a fundamental shift?
I think it is a fundamental shift. In about 5 years' time, these drugs, along with statins and blood pressure medications and a few other medications, will probably become foundational in the treatment of heart disease, in part because they further help lower the risk of future heart disease, but they also tackle obesity. And obesity in many people with chronic disease is a major problem because it also stresses many other organ systems and leads them, individuals, to develop more diabetes, more kidney disease, more heart failure. So by also tackling the obesity in individuals at risk of complications like heart disease, we help people live longer but with less disease, and we also help improve their quality of life in a way that perhaps few other drugs do.
I mean, this is a lot of people, isn't it, potentially?
There's a huge number of people. Cardiologists and Riaz will probably also already tell you are already using these drugs in a small amount, but this will accelerate the use. The question is it going to be affordable in the next few years? Possibly not. There will be competition to use these drugs in many other individuals living with obesity, with other chronic conditions. We need more training. We need more resource. But the hope is in about 4 or 5 years' time, when some of these drugs start to come off patent, the costs will come down substantially and we will be able to afford the wider use of these drugs in people with heart disease and many other chronic conditions.
And just to say, when we're mentioning diabetes, we're talking about type 2 in this context. Let me bring in Professor Riaz Patel to this conversation. What is your view of this change?
So I would agree with Naveed. I think this is a really important step from NICE.
And just quickly, who's eligible in terms of the kind of cardiovascular risk for those listening?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure lots of people are very interested about this right now. So it's important to note this is for people with established cardiovascular disease, which specifically means people who've had a heart attack and survived those, as well as a stroke or arterial disease in their legs. So any of those three main conditions would make you eligible, along with a BMI that's over 27.
And how does it work, the drug, to help?
Really important question. So we are still trying to figure out exactly why it's giving so many benefits to heart patients. We suspect some of it is due to sort of changes in adiposity and metabolic effects, but there are lots of other effects that we're still trying to understand.
Does it matter that we don't understand them?
Not necessarily. There are several drugs that we currently use that we don't fully understand, but it does obviously make us more comfortable using them more widely once we've elicited exactly the benefits.
Okay. And I mean, I suppose the question about you take the benefits, but, concerns around any long-term use of issue. I mean, people have been taking them for different reasons. Some negative side effects, of course, are out in the public domain, whether it's worsening eyesight, some mental health issues. What do you say to those who, like the sound of this, want the help but are nervous?
I think the way to approach this is to say that we will get more data as these drugs are used for longer periods, but currently the available data suggests that they're quite safe. And the commonest things are probably going to be the gastrointestinal kind of side effects of nausea, vomiting and diarrhea, which happen in a few patients. So it will remain to be seen how many people can stay on these drugs for a long duration, because some of them might need to take them for many, many years.
If you get those gastro side effects, will they usually calm down, do you think? Is that what we know?
I I defer to experts like Naveed on these sorts of questions.
Naveed, let me ask you that, yeah. Sorry.
I know they do. So a proportion of people do have more side effects initially, but as people get used to the drugs, they do calm down. And what we're learning as a medical profession is we start the drugs at a low dose and we titrate up the dose very slowly. And if we do that, we're able to reduce the side effects. And we've got other mechanisms, how people eat and the way they eat, and we give them advice on that. We can actually substantially reduce the side effects, and we've really improved the way we give these drugs. And many more people now living with obesity who are doing well on the drugs and are staying on them long term. So, so I think things are improving.
How quickly will this be rolled out?
Ah, That's a good question. It's not immediate, you know, you're not going to have in next year a million people on these drugs for living with heart disease. It's going to take time. Having said that, I think unlike many other drugs, there is a clamour from patients to want to have drugs that also help them target weight.
Yes.
We've often stigmatized people because of obesity, and that's the wrong thing to have done. Obesity predominantly is an environmentally driven disease. You know, the environment is so obesogenic these days. So helping people be at a lower weight than they would be otherwise is something people want. It helps them, as I say, improve their quality of life. So my sense is it will be relatively modestly slow. I mean, I think over the next few years, it will go ramp up. But in about 5 years' time, when the drugs come off patent, I think a whole host of new people living with heart disease and with obesity will be started on these drugs regularly.
Well, there'll be time, I suppose, alongside that to talk about the costs, the benefits and some of what you've gone into there and the questions, not least from patients. Professor Naveed Sattar, Professor Riaz Patel, thank you to both of you.
26 minutes past 8 to the sport. Here's Mike.
Well, Justin, I'm proud to say that the sport bulletins on this programme are nothing if not varied. Last hour, we heard from a very proud Iraq football fan celebrating his country qualifying for their first World Cup in 40 years. This hour, the boat race, the 2026 edition of one of the oldest British sporting spectacles, is this weekend with the men's and women's races on Saturday. And I have been speaking to the two women who will lead their teams down on the River Thames this weekend, the presidents of Oxford and Cambridge University Boat Clubs. 26-year-old Gemma King from Cambridge is competing in her third boat race, whilst Oxford's Heidi Long, who's 29, will contest her second. Heidi also won a bronze medal for Team GB at the Paris Olympics 2 years ago. So I started by asking her about the difference between rowing at the Olympics and the historic boat race.
I mean, they're both fantastic races. I feel so lucky to be able to race in both of them. But boat race is really unique. You just have your two Oxford and Cambridge boats racing down the Tideway in London. And it's a really intense time with the team that you've got building into this. We only come together about 7 months before the race and really build our whole team and women's squad throughout the year to represent Oxford University across the blue boat, reserves race, and the lightweights and the spares as well.
And Gemma, I guess it's exactly the same for Cambridge. You train for the best part of a whole year for this one moment. It all comes down to this.
Yeah, it's definitely a full-on year. We started this year with a really big squad with people from all sorts of different backgrounds and bringing everyone together and making sure that those boats are moving as fast as they can and everyone's really giving their all to the programme is something that's really exciting to see how it progresses throughout the year.
Is there really still a rivalry between Oxford and Cambridge these days, Heidi, or are you all the best of friends?
Oh, no, there's definitely a big rivalry. Both crews really want to win and both universities really want to win. But we respect each other's training so much. We respect each other's programmes. And without the other university fielding fantastic crews, there wouldn't be this amazing race. I'm sure Cambridge want to win just as much as we do, but we are definitely there to go out and win the races. But once the racing's done, it's really great to be able to spend a bit of time with each other and just also have that time off the water because we can connect and be friends on the other side of it.
Gemma, how do you prepare for the ever-variable, ever-changing conditions that we face in the British springtime? What kind of weather you're expecting down on the water?
I guess one of the main ways that we prepare for this is throughout the year we will row in whatever the weather. So whether it's really windy, whether it's pouring with rain, we're out there in the freezing cold early mornings. And that just prepares you for pretty much anything that can be thrown at you. I think it's looking like it may well be quite windy conditions, but we've been out in windy conditions, so we can't control what the weather's doing. We can just make sure that we adapt as best as we can to the conditions and row our best through them.
And I think I'm right in saying that the boat race is one of, if not the largest, free-to-attend sporting events in the UK. Just tell us a little bit about the atmosphere down on the banks of the River Thames. And for you as a rower, can you actually hear yourself think, or are you able to cancel out all the noise when you're in the boat?
It's crazy, but I just can only hear my coxswain. So the cox sits at the front or the back of our boat as we row backwards, and they do the steering and the calls throughout our race plan. And that's the only voice I can hear. I can sometimes hear the rest of our crew, but it's almost like the banks go quiet and it's just us there in our boat racing our race. in the warm-up when we walk down carrying the boat through the Putney Embankment, that is when I really take in all of that noise. And it's just incredible to have so much support and just rowing be such a great spectacle on that day.
And Gemma, I believe next year is the centenary edition of the women's boat race, 1927, the first ever women's race. How important is it for you and how proud are you that your sport, rowing, puts the men's and women's events alongside each other with equal top billing across boat race weekend?
Oh, it means so much to have that parity across the women's race and the men's race. I think there's barely any events in sporting history that have this sort of history behind them and have been going for this long. And the legacies and traditions that go with it are just so inspiring. And in 2015, the race moved to the Tideway, to where the men have always raced. We're so grateful to everyone who, back in 1927, started those boat races and also who managed to push for that move to the Tideway, as we wouldn't be here doing what we're doing without them.
Gemma put it really, really well. It's thanks to all of the people that put in that work to create this gender parity in this race. And I am so proud to be one of the women that gets to go out there and race in front of the crowd on the same playing field as the men do. I just think it is a fantastic moment for women's rowing as well. It keeps pushing on every single year. We're standing on the shoulders of giants that have come before us. I just encourage any young girls and any women out there that want to get involved in rowing to give it a go, because you never know where it could lead you.
Great speaking there to Heidi Long from Oxford and Gemma King from Cambridge University Boat Club. And a reminder, the boat race gets underway this Saturday. The men's race course, because of the tidal times, very precise start times. The men's race, 3:21 p.m. and the women's race, 2:21.
Thanks, Mike. Now, just to say, Dr. Sean Williams can tell us a bit more of her, about her series coming up on Radio 4 in half an hour.
Some events have far-reaching consequences.
The white noise, everything goes black, and apparently I was screaming. That's the moment that my life changed forever.
I'm Dr. Sean Williams, and I'm meeting the people whose lives have been reshaped in unexpected ways.
That broke my heart, because I just thought that is so cruel.
Personal stories of loss, discovery, and starting over.
We do talk about it time to time, and about how grateful we are to be in this country, to be able to be free.
The new series of Life Changing, this morning at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
To the weather, the north is going to be cloudy. It will clear to showers later. There'll be snow, though, on Scottish hills. It'll be dry with variable cloud further south, patchy rain moving in from the north by the evening.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Emma Barnett. It's 28 minutes to 9, and a summary of the news with Jane Steele.
President Trump has said US forces are finishing the job in Iran and could end attacks very soon, in 2 or 3 weeks, whether or not there is a peace deal. Oil prices have fallen sharply this morning, with Brent crude down almost 5% to $99 a barrel. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has hinted that any government help with energy bills won't happen until the autumn. She said the Treasury was working on a range of contingencies. The NHS in England is to prescribe the weight loss drug Wegovy to more than 1 million patients who are overweight and at risk of heart attacks and strokes. Data showed the drug reduced such medical emergencies by 20% when used alongside medicines such as statins. Professor Naveed Sattar, chair of the Obesity Healthcare Goals Programme for the government, he told this programme this was a fundamental shift and weight loss drugs could be foundational in treating such illnesses. NASA says its lunar mission is on track and the rocket could possibly launch tonight. It's hoped Artemis 2 will take 4 astronauts on a 10-day journey around the moon and back.
Thank you for that. It is 26 minutes to 9. We heard an hour ago from the government on its answer to cost of living pressures. Let us hear what the Liberal Democrats would do or indeed not do. Callum Miller is on the line, the Liberal Democrat MP who sits on Ed Davies' front bench. Morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
And we're just hearing there in the news that the Chancellor has confirmed, she'd be talking to our colleagues on BBC Breakfast, that future energy bill support will be targeted, so it's not going to go to everyone, which was widely expected, I think. Also that it won't arrive until the autumn, again, widely expected. Is she getting that right?
Well, households up and down the country, Justin, are fearful of these price rises, and we can already see the impact that's having on everybody. The trouble with Rachel Reeves' approach is that she is being unclear about who will be aided. She's being unclear about when they'll be aided. And that's having a really big impact on households' decision making. There's a real danger that this dither and delay by the government will push households into difficult decisions and push the economy into a recession.
What should they be doing?
We need to have clarity about knowing that the government will stand behind people. We've seen how quickly oil prices have gone up as a result of Donald Trump's reckless war in the Middle East. I hope that they will come down again. You're reporting today that Donald Trump is saying that the war may come to an end soon and that he believes prices will come down. If they do, that's a good news for the economy. But what households need at the moment is some reassurance, and they need to know that the government will stand behind them and give them support.
I suppose what the government was saying, we had the Chief Secretary of the Treasury on yesterday, and he said this when I was trying to press him on what the plan was. He said, look, we don't know, because for exactly the reasons you just come up with, because we don't really know what's going on yet. And when something happens that does have a material impact on energy prices, then we will act. So in a sense, they say people already have that sureness that you're asking for.
Well, I think what we can see from people's behaviour, and I think what most households feel, is they don't feel confident as a result of that reassurance from James Murray. What they are looking for is the government to say that they see what's going on, that they recognise the government itself is benefiting from a boost in revenues, for example, the VAT it's receiving at the petrol pump, and that in light of that, the government's going to take some sensible decisions.
Should it be targeted?
Well, we, the Liberal Democrats, for example, have said that the government should immediately rule out the fuel duty increase in September. It's bringing in VAT receipts already. It can give people that reassurance when it comes to pump prices.
And how would you pay for that?
Well, as I say, the government's already taking in significant increased VAT revenues as a consequence of unexpected increases in the oil price.
Although it's also paying more for its debt, isn't it? So in a sense, that is balanced out by that. I think you'd have to find some extra money, wouldn't you? Or this government is going to have to if it doesn't go ahead with that fuel duty rise. So, I mean, do you accept that there may be a need then to find extra money to pay for the abolishing of the abandonment of that rise?
There are certainly challenges around it, Justin, but I think the thing we need to remember is that in the end, the one thing this Labour government has singularly failed to do over its 20 months in office is to deliver any growth in the UK economy. And the risk that you have at the moment is a delay by the government in providing confidence to households is the kind of thing that would cause them to stop spending money and tip the UK into recession, meaning that there will be fewer tax receipts across the board. I'm not pretending it's an easy decision for the government, but what households are crying out for up and down the country is some reassurance that their government will stand behind them and that they can operate with some confidence in the next few months.
And what businesses are crying out for, and we hear it on this programme again and again and again, is stable energy prices. They know that they're not going to fall precipitately anytime soon, but they don't want them to rise. Indeed, they'd like them to fall a bit, and they'd like them to be stable. And obviously, part of that is the war, but part of it also is our decisions the nation has made about the extent to which we load onto companies the costs of net zero, and also the decisions we make of an environmental nature not to drill or not to continue to extract from the North Sea. I don't know if you've seen the chief executive of one of the North Sea companies telling the Times today, his man called Neil McCulloch, that he could actually get gas out of the Jackdaw gas field, which is one of these gas fields that currently isn't going ahead because it's been challenged in the courts. He says he could get it out. He could be getting it out soon, as early as the winter, which seems extraordinary, will seem extraordinary to many people that we're not just doing that. If the Liberal Democrats were in charge, would they allow it to happen?
Well, there's a lot in your question, Justin, but let me be very clear. In the long run, the UK needs stable, homegrown energy sources, so we're not dependent on the kind of volatility we can see in the Middle East just now. I have to say, I listen with some scepticism to the companies that want to extract from the North Sea suddenly seizing on this crisis to make their case. The amount that they would supply is fairly minimal. It wouldn't be guaranteed to come to the UK. It would simply add to international markets. And therefore, they're holding out the prospect that somehow this would increase UK security or reduce UK prices. It's just not true. What is important is that we, as you say, provide stability and confidence to all manner of industry. And what we mustn't have from the government is the kind of flip-flopping that the Conservatives are now advocating, where we advocate one long-term energy strategy one week and then turn our backs on it the following week. The businesses that are making the right choices to invest in renewables in this country, to invest in nuclear, and to provide us with energy stability in the long run shouldn't be unsettled by a government that's willing to flip-flop as a result of pressure from industry. We need to stay the course.
Callum Miller, Liberal Democrat MP, sits on Ed Davies' front bench. Thank you very much. And I should say we will be talking to all the parties about the cost of living during the course of the next month or so.
It's 20 to 9. Tiger Woods has said he will step away from golf to seek treatment and focus on his health after his arrest on suspicion of driving under the influence following a rollover crash near his Florida home. He pleaded not guilty and demanded a jury trial after the crash, which was on a residential road near his house in Jupiter Island. That's according to court records released on Tuesday earlier this week. Kevin Van Valkenburg is the director of content at Fried Egg Golf, which is a sports media network. And I spoke to him a bit earlier and I asked him what the reaction to this statement, which came out first on social media from Tiger Woods, has been.
The response, I think, is generally positive. Just the idea that Tiger kind of embraced the idea that he needed help, that he was going to take some time away from golf. I think the nightmare scenario for a lot of people would be that he would just sort of push through this and pretend like he didn't have anything to deal with, and that he would try to play the Masters next week. And what an awkward situation that would be for everyone to watch him grind through and be in pain and wonder, you know, whether he's ever going to deal with some of these issues that are obviously plaguing him. So
what are those issues? I know you cover golf, but what are these issues that he has? How can we describe them?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's fair to say that Tiger has been in tremendous amount of pain for a long time and has at times sought to use, you know, medication, to use opioids to deal with some of that pain. He had been once previously to a rehab facility after a previous car crash, checked himself in and to deal with a dependence on pain medication. It was very clear to not call it an addiction, but a dependence back then. And so this is not the first time. You know, he had a couple hydrocortisone in his pocket, which sort of seemed pretty clear that, you know, that he takes those things regularly. And so I think that it's, you know, there's been a feeling behind the scenes that something was going on with Tiger. He wasn't always like as sharp as he once was, or, you know, he'll often show up at some of these TGL sort of events kind of sweating a lot or kind of just not looking like his normal self.
Is he in pain from an injury, or what's the pain from?
Yeah, certainly pain from, you know, 10 million swings over the years. And then he's had, I think, 7 back surgeries, you know, pain from a previous car accident where he almost lost his right leg.
There's a lot going on there, and then how the management of that has worked and how it's affected him is sort of what we saw in you know, for some, even if you perhaps it was still shocking, even if you knew of some of this, what we saw very recently around you know, the footage of him and the reports around his arrest. What does this mean for his golf career?
I think, you know, Tiger is very big on saying never count me out. You know, every person who wrote him off, and I would be probably among those people, looked silly when he came back in 2019 and won the Masters. But I think realistically what has to kind of, you know, be the focus going forward is the rest of Tiger's life that doesn't involve competitive golf. You know, he has 2 kids who he's obviously cares a lot about, has tried to be a good father to them despite, you know, the divorce of he and his wife 10 years ago or so. And I think that has to be the focus. If Tiger plays any more competitive golf going forward, it's going to look very different than what it looked in the past. And I think
is he still incredible?
Certainly incredible in, you know, he always likes to say that he can hit all the shots, still he just can't walk between the holes. And the walking is kind of an important part of
golf,
you know, professional golf. Now, there, his hope has often been that he could play on what's called the Champions Tour, which is for, you know, the older golfers who can take a cart. I think he was really looking forward to that. He'd even signed up to potentially participate in the Senior U.S. Open this year. But I just think that realistically, he needs to kind of figure out a way to move on and find other challenges and joys that don't involve trying to win the Masters.
Kevin Van Valkenburgh, thank you very much.
The time, 9:15. There is news this morning from China. The Chinese foreign minister saying that the two countries, actually the foreign ministry rather than the minister, saying that China and Pakistan, these two countries, are making new efforts to advocate for peace in the Middle East. Let's talk to our China correspondent, Laura Bicker. What's happening, Laura?
Well, here we are, China trying to step in as peacemaker into and mediate in a war that involves the other superpower, the United States. So China is joining Pakistan, which has emerged as a bit of an unlikely mediator in this war, saying that they've provided this five-point plan with the aim of bringing about an immediate ceasefire and reopening that vital Strait of Hormuz. Now, for China, this is a bit of a turnaround. Their official response to the war so far has been quite muted. So why is it stepping in now? Well, the peace plan was drafted. The Pakistan foreign minister flew here to Beijing yesterday, asked for Chinese support for the country's efforts. So obviously they're joining it. For China, it might be a bit about oil. That'll be a bit of a concern. It is the biggest importer of crude oil in the world. It does have enough stockpiles to get it through the next few months. But key to this is because this war in Iran jeopardised something that President Xi covets more than anything else, and that is stability. China needs a stable global economy as it's heavily reliant on selling goods around the world. So that's one of the reasons why China's probably stepped in around now.
What does it say about the relationship between President Trump and the Chinese? Because Trump is due to go there, isn't he? And of course, the United States could have stopped the oil that is going to China currently going there. They've got a huge naval presence in the area. They've chosen not to do that. How would you characterise what's going on in that relationship?
I think when it comes to Beijing, although in this they are playing this kind of stable superpower, trying to kind of push President Xi as an alternative leader of the global world order, I think when it comes to this, they will want to placate Washington in some ways. They won't want to anger Donald Trump because he's due here in just over a month's time. And they need these talks on trade to go well. Remember, we've had that really bruising tariff war over the last year. So China wants that to come to an end too.
Laura Becker in China. Thank you.
9:13. Campfires and barbecues will be banned in the Cairngorms National Park today, as part of moves to curb the risk of wildfires. It's hoped that the seasonal bylaw, which will be in place until September 30th, will help reduce the risk in the face of climate change, which has led to longer, drier spring and summer months. I'm joined now by Grant Moore, Chief Executive of the National Park. Grant, tell us a bit more. I started to explain why the need to bring in the ban, but you tell us, and also how can you enforce this?
Last year we had the largest ever wildfire in Scottish history, which over 10,000 hectares of land was burnt through that. We've been working over the past couple of years to bring forward this bylaw as part of a wider package around sort of wildfire management within the national park. Today is the introduction of it. In terms of it'll be enforced through our ranger service and also through the police services in the area as well.
And I suppose in terms of what that will mean, I mean, do you think this will affect a lot of people? What do you think the response will be?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, my hope would be that we don't have to hand out any fines at all and that we get compliance by the fact that people want to do the right thing within the national park. I mean, people want to come and enjoy a national park and they want to protect a national park, and not having a fire or a barbecue is part of that these days as we've got a changing climate. But people can still use a gas stove if they want to cook something when they're out camping. But it's about trying to make sure that we don't have any sparks going into the national park and having ignition points that might lead to a wildfire.
Do you think the impact of those fires that happened, you know, you can tell us a bit more of on the local wildlife and the flora and fauna. Do you think that people know of those, the harms and the impact?
I suspect that probably wildfire isn't the first thing that pops into your mind when you think about Scotland or the UK. I think we're going to have to change, I suppose, people's behaviours around that, just because we are getting a changing climate. We have got these longer, drier spells within the UK and within national parks, and we want to make sure that we protect the wildlife and the landscape of the national park, but also the communities of the national park. 18,000 people live within the Cairngorms, so we've got to make sure that we protect people as well in terms of these threats that are happening more and more.
And so the ban is from today, is that right?
That's right, it starts today and it lasts until the 30th of September. seasonal bylaw, and people will be out and about, and there'll be plenty of signs and campaigns to make sure that people are aware of it long before they get to the point of actually having a camp or sitting and thinking about having a fire.
The Chief Executive there, thanks very much, of the Cairngorms National Park. Thank you.
It is 50 years since Apple was invented, famously in a garage in California. Since then, the company has become, well, it's become Apple. David Pogue is the author and broadcaster who has written Apple the First 50 Years.
I think every company in the world claims that they strive for excellence. But what I learned from these 150 interviews is that Apple, its culture is really something different. It is very intense there. And when they say they strive for excellence, I mean, they go miles out of their way. There are 1,000 examples, but they pull out every stop to make everything work as well as it can. And it's hard to find.
And allied to that, the design of the products.
Yeah, design is another through line. I mean, when Apple came along 50 years ago, computers were ugly industrial metal equipment. And it was Steve Jobs who said, why can't they be attractive? Why can't they be beautiful like any other thing in your home? And I would say Apple's stuff is still among the most beautiful in the world. It's still a through line of all 50 years.
Pricey, though.
Yes and no. Have you seen the new MacBook Neo?
Yeah, fair point. I mean, they are. That's an interesting one, isn't it? So, yes, it was pricey, but actually they're now going into a new market, which is less so. Why is that?
I think Tim Cook's, the CEO, Tim Cook's thing has always been, I'm not a product guy. I'll never be Steve Jobs dreaming up new inventions to revolutionize the world every 3 years. But what I can do is squeeze all the juice out of what we have. So he, for example, built up Apple's ability to make his own chips. He multiplied the number of iPhones available. And he is now thinking, well, why are we leaving money on the table at the low end? Why can't we bring beauty and coherence of hardware and software to less expensive things? And I think a big part of that is that Tim Cook has made Apple into a services company, Apple Pay, Apple Music, Apple TV, and all that stuff. So if he sells inexpensive devices, those are like on-ramps to a new generation of people who will then use the services.
He's also been very careful about his relationship with Donald Trump, hasn't he, Tim Cook?
Why?
Because a lot of people have been, people who don't like Donald Trump, have been surprised by his closeness to Trump. What is he trying to achieve?
I don't know if it's closeness to Donald Trump or his manipulation of Donald Trump. Oh. In other words, Trump was threatening these devastating tariffs that would have driven up the cost of an iPhone to $3,000. And that would have been a no-win situation for the public and for Apple and for shareholders, for everybody. So my take on it is Cook did an extremely pragmatic, practical, almost manipulative maneuver and handed Trump a trophy. And I don't know if people can have their own opinions about whether it was worth it to violate his own personal principles to do that. But it did work. I mean, the tariffs never happened.
What has Apple got wrong?
Oh, man. I mean, Apple's history is strewn with failure. I mean, the Apple I was not much of a seller. They sold 150 of those. The Apple II was a huge hit. 6 million, introduced the whole world to personal computers. But then the next three, the Apple III failed. The Apple Lisa failed. The Macintosh failed for many years. Apple recently spent $10 billion and a decade working on the Apple car. They never got there on that one. So part of Apple's culture is trying new things, skunkworks projects all over the company. Most of the things Apple does you never hear of because they get canceled before they reach the finish line.
So its future is what, do you think?
I think its future is very solid, if only because 2.5 billion people are carrying around Apple devices right now, 31% of every man, woman, and child on Earth. Apple has a long runway. It can tread water for a couple of years before anything bad starts to happen, and Apple won't do that.
David Pogue, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It's 6 minutes to nine. Well, let's go slightly less tech, shall we? Picasso's famous 1937 anti-war painting, Guernica, has found itself at the centre of a political tug of war. The Basque regional government has renewed calls for a temporary loan of it from Madrid's Reina Sofia Museum. It's being suggested that because of Spain's prime minister being dependent on the support of two Basque parties in parliament, that this call, that's the reason it hasn't been turned down immediately. But a report has been published suggesting that moving it temporarily to the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, the region whose suffering inspired its creation, is strongly discouraged because transport vibrations could harm its condition and increase its deterioration. Emmanuel Prathelas, leader of the Basque regional government, says it's been moved before and this shouldn't be the end of the matter. I think it would be a serious political error to close the door on this because of this conservation report that the Reina Sofia Museum has made public. Given that October 7th, 2026 marks the 90th anniversary of the first Basque government in history and that April 26th, 2027, the 90th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica, we are requesting a temporary relocation linked to the anniversaries as a form of reparation and a way of preserving historical memory. It is also a way to acknowledge, in this geopolitical moment, the impact of war.
Geopolítico de lo que supone una guerra.
Listening to that, Dr. Nicola Ashmore, Principal Lecturer in Art and Design History and an expert on Guernica as a form of social activism from the University of Brighton. Nicola, may you remind us, first of all, if people can't bring it to mind, of the painting, why it was commissioned and the fact it was commissioned?
Certainly. Good morning, everybody. So why it was commissioned? So this was by the democratically elected Republican Party. And they wanted to put a painting by Picasso on display in Paris at this international exhibition. And to bring to mind, the Spanish pavilion was sandwiched between the German pavilion, the Nazi pavilion on one side, and the Russian pavilion on the other. And Picasso's Guernica was displayed in the Spanish pavilion. And so would you like me to describe the image a little bit?
Yes, just briefly if you can.
Yes, certainly. So it's a very large-scale painting, just over 7 metres long by almost 4 metres high. And it's a chaotic composition of death and despair, including a mother holding her dead baby on the far left. We have a person on the far right reaching up trapped in a burning building. And we have a woman dragging herself along and a dead soldier along the bottom. And in the centre, which creates this kind of pyramid shape, we have a horse in death throes, which all of which is illuminated by a figure with their arms stretched out, holding a candle.
I mean, you've done a great job of describing it. Thank you. It's obviously incredibly powerful. The discussion of it at the moment, this particular discussion, not about what it depicts, but about whether it should travel. What, I mean, that may not be your area, but what is your view, or what certainly what's your reaction to it being at this, as it's been described, in the centre of a political tug of war?
I think it is, and there is a history of these requests around these important anniversaries coming through. And I think what it does, if nothing else, is it keeps the conversation alive, which I think is incredibly valuable and actually links back to what Picasso had hoped for Guernica in the first place, because it toured extensively once it'd been created and displayed in Paris. It went throughout Scandinavia, into the UK, and then it travelled extensively around America. And the purpose of that was to keep the conversation going around what was going on in Spain and the rise of fascism.
Well, I suppose, you know, in many ways, keeping the conversation going around the themes that are raised feels more apposite than ever, but this argument that it can't move, it shouldn't move, it will be damaged.
Yes, I mean, there will be an impact on the painting, but it has a history of being moved. And part of me feels like if its purpose is to generate this conversation and to be seen, and this is an important anniversary. So I feel like it's important for them to explore the very real possibility of moving. And this movement, this travel through the country could be made into an important moment to actually celebrate, mark, note this important anniversary.
Just briefly, did Picasso want it travelled?
Oh, yes. Yes, and actually, really interestingly, from a very early stage,